Dann habt ihr dann über von einer Kopf mein Kopf.
Are you sure? Are you
definitely. No,
okay,
no.
All right, I'll move it next door. Thank you. Oh!
How are you? I'm fine, thank you. You were done yesterday.
Mama, can you go
ahead? I'm so good.
How many minutes are we
at? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
To do what I mean.
Don't see you around.
This thing says,
oh, that's from the computer.
Good morning, honorable members. I think we should start the meeting now. According to the rules of Parliament, in the absence of the chairperson, we have to elect an acting chairperson. An acting chairperson, are there any nominations? Yes, Monica.
Thank you. I would like to nominate Honorable Suleiman to be the chairperson of the day.
Any seconder?
Congratulations, Mr. Suleiman. You are the chairperson of this committee. You may come and take your seat.
Just try it, or just try it. Where are you?
Good morning. Honourable members, good morning. This is from the medical team. First of all, I would like to ask the secretary for any apologies.
It's Ms. Makubele Mashele only.
Thank you. Now, I would like to welcome all the honourable members here to this meeting. And officials from the medical scene, you are also welcome here. I don't know if all are here present are here already. We've got three medical scenes, Discovery, Bonitas, and Fat Health. I don't know whether all of them are here. Okay, it seems to me all three are here. Fat Health is here. Discovery. Okay, so they're on their way. Okay, thank you. Honorable members, officials, I've got a time allocation here in front of me. It seems to me that this meeting will be so 1:15. But I would like to apologize up front. I've got another commitment at 12:45. Hopefully, we will be finished by then. I hope so. Okay. I see here a time allocation. They got for 55 minutes medical scheme, and then another 20 minutes for discussions, asking of questions, stuff like that. Maybe we can cut on that also. And I do believe that we must lead also by example. We must at least three hours midway in between, we must have some stretch, the blood circulation, walk around for 5 or 10 minutes, go to the toilet or do something. So we will be having a short break midway. Okay, I'm first going to, I do not believe we as members will introduce ourselves. As we proceed asking questions, we can introduce ourselves to the time constraint. I would just like to ask the medical schemes, they introduce themselves so that we can know who we are speaking to. I'll ask Discovery, Dr. Jonathan Broomberg. I don't know who he is now. Dr. Broomberg, will you just shortly introduce your people who are with you?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Committee. I'm Dr. Jonathan Broomberg, the Chief Executive of Discovery Health. Our delegation here represents both the medical scheme, Discovery Health Medical Scheme, represented by Mr. Milton Street, and Discovery Health, which is the administrator of Discovery Health Medical Scheme, but also, as we will show you, 14 other medical schemes. And my colleagues from Discovery Health are Dr. Penny Klavi on my right and Dr. Mandy Mzimba next to Penny. So there are four of us all together representing both Discovery Health and the schemes that we administer.
Thank you, Doctor. Broomberg. Now, I think if Bonitas are present, are they already here? Who is the I didn't get your name yet. Mr. Gerard, will you introduce just quickly your members? You can use my mic here. And
why can't they come this side? So, because they are going to use mic, they shouldn't be there.
Honourable members, the problem is now space there. So I think Discovery will be the first. Then they move from away then. I just have the introduction done, so you know who are we are dealing with. Then we can.
Good morning, everybody. Firstly, thank you for the honor. My name is Gerard van Emnes. I'm the acting principal officer of Bonitas Medical Fund. I will be the only person representing Bonitas here today. I was brought up that the stronger your case, the less people you need to present. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Pet Health, Ms. Kitty Gowdes, the principal officer. Pronouncing it correctly.
It's Katie Gowdes. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm the principal officer to Fed Health Medical Scheme, and I'm accompanied here today by three of our board members, trustees, Mr. Nazir Parker, Mr. Malcolm Khan, and Dr. Nati Finkelstein.
Thank you. That's done now. We are most welcome here, and I do believe there will be a fruitful presentation and discussion. So we'll start immediately with Discovery. You've got 55 minutes. If you can do it in, say, 5-10 minutes less, then we'll have more time. Over to you, Doctor.
Thank you. As Johnny has said, thank you very much for the opportunity. I hope you don't mind that I'm sitting down so I can speak into the mic. And this is a direct response to the invitation to come and speak to you about the environment in which we operate and also talk to you about the Discovery business model and operating model. So we welcome the opportunity, and I hope you find our presentation productive. And so just in terms of the structure of the presentation, Johnny and I will share the presentation. I'll do the first two items on the agenda, which are quite short, just to make sure that we're on the same page in terms of understanding the lay of the land, talking to you about the role, different role players in the industry and what they do, and secondly, about the key challenges that we see in the industry. And then Johnny will speak to you specifically about our business model and then operating model. So just in terms of who the key role players are in the funding industry, firstly, we have the Department of Health, which sets policy and, of course, their stewardship role over the whole industry. We have the Council for Medical Schemes, that is the regulator for medical schemes, and they have the Medical Schemes Act that they use in order to regulate the industry. And just yesterday, we know that they've just appointed a new registrar for the Council for Medical Schemes. So in terms of the funding mechanism, we have, and I think we have to emphasize this point, We have the medical scheme, which Milton is the principal officer, which is a not-for-profit entity. It's a separate legal entity. It has a separate governing structure, which is the Board of Trustees, 50% of whom must be member elected. And so they set policy and they contract with various service providers, including us as the administrator. So there are service levels agreements that govern the relationship between the administrator and the medical scheme. The medical scheme pays an admin fee to the administrator. And on the other side, you on the delivery of healthcare, you have members and doctors and hospitals. So members interact with the service providers, and the service providers then give us claims, and we submit claims, and we pay them. So this is how members pay premiums together with the employer to the medical scheme. So this is how the medical schemes industry works. This is the structure, and these are the various role players and their functions. So in terms of the members of medical schemes and the employed structure of employment in South Africa, we have 3.5 million members of medical schemes, which is equivalent of 8 million beneficiaries. So the total number of people in medical schemes are 8 million, 3.5 million principal members and their dependents, which makes them 8 million. We have, in terms of formally employed and uninsured, we have another 5.2 million people. Informally employed and uninsured, 3.8 million, and unemployed, 5.4. So as you can see, there is a relatively small number of people that participate in the medical schemes industry, and it's, as a result of the structure of employment, the high rate of unemployment, and of course the fact that a lot of the people are employed in an informal sector. Just in terms of the legislation that is governing the medical schemes industry, as I said, it is the Medical Schemes Act of 1998. We have two types of medical schemes in the industry. We have open schemes as well as restricted schemes. And the total number of schemes is 110, 33 open schemes and 77 restricted schemes. And in terms of the differences between the two, the open schemes like Discovery, Bonitas, and FedHealth are open to any member of the public. So they are not limited by employment, they're not limited by any other restrictions. Any member of the public can apply. The restricted schemes can be limited by an employer, so we have a number of employers who elect not to join an open scheme and have their own medical schemes, and only the employees and retirees of that employer are allowed to join them. But in terms of the key elements of the Medical Schemes Act, we have open enrollment, which means anybody can apply, and guaranteed acceptance. When somebody applies, you are not allowed to decline membership, and no conditions can be permanently excluded. Community rating means that the premiums, you can only use the structure of, or the family composition, you can only use the plan type and income level to determine premiums. You're not allowed to use the state of health or previous claims or something like that. So the only things you are allowed to use in order to set a premium are the family composition, plan type, and income level. Prescribed minimum benefits are the schemes by law I have to cover 271 diagnostic treatments and treatment pairs and 26 chronic conditions, and all schemes have to cover that by law. And in terms of the reserve requirement, 25% of gross contributions have to be set aside in order to make sure that the schemes are financially sound and sustainable in the long term. Just in terms of the flow of the member contributions and the payments, like I said, premiums are contributed, are collected by the medical scheme, and then the medical scheme contracts with an administrator who does the administration and the managed care, and they pay claims. And in terms of the claims, they're paid to the hospital, to the healthcare professionals, and to the medicine, to medicines, and 6.1% to others. In terms of the health professionals, we've got GPs, specialists, and all other professionals. Admin fees are 9.4% of the contributions. Managed care, another. This is in terms of the Discovery specific now. It's not the industry, so we're talking specifically about the Discovery Health flow of cash. 9.4 goes to administration, another 2.9 to managed care, 2.5% goes for broker commission, and about less than 1% goes for contribution to reserves, because last December we reached the 25% statutory requirement of 25% of gross contributions. So now only less than 1% is collected. It goes towards the reserves requirement. So just in terms of the key issues that are facing the industry, we believe that the first one is maintaining affordability and sustainability, and the second one is growth, especially coverage to the uninsured. So just about in terms of the sustainability, as you can see, medical inflation always is much higher than normal inflation. But this is not a South Africa-specific issue. It's a global issue. All healthcare systems in the world are struggling with this issue of maintaining or controlling medical inflation. And the main issues driving the costs in the industry are, number one, just higher demand. It's people are becoming more and more aware and more educated. They are demanding more in terms of healthcare. You've got an aging and ailing population. Populations are aging, and that comes with higher incidence of chronic conditions of cancer. But also you've got a burden of disease in South Africa, in particular HIV, but also chronic conditions. In terms of technological advances, we've got better and better treatments. An example are biologics and Herceptin, but that comes with a higher cost. We've got scarcity of skills in South Africa in particular. We've got a scarcity of doctors and specialists in particular. Asymmetry of information means that the people who are supplying the services tend to know much more than the people who consume the services, and that leads to all sorts of perverse incentives. And the last one is that irrational consumer behavior. With direct-to-consumer advertising and consumers getting more and more educated, they're demanding more and more healthcare, more the latest and the best, regardless of whether it's cost-effective. So these are the main issues driving costs in the industry. And as I said, I need to emphasize it's not just a South Africa-specific issue. It is worldwide. This is just an illustration of the point I made. On the left-hand side, we're looking at the prevalence of HIV, and as you can see, it has grown quite significantly. On the right-hand side, it's chronic conditions as well as cancer. So as you can see, like I made the point that because of lifestyle conditions, the disease burden of chronic conditions is just increasing, as well as that of cancer. So these are the main reasons driving the increasing disease burden in South Africa. And another issue that's driving costs is the scarcity of the health professionals, in particular doctors. As you can see, we've looked at the number of physicians per 10,000 population. South Africa is the light brown color there. And as you can see, in comparison, even with other third world countries, including Mexico and Brazil, we have a scarcity of physicians per 10,000 population. So this drives them. Because it's a supply and demand issue, it drives up costs in the environment. In terms of extending reach of medical coverage to the uninsured or to the low-income population, medical scheme membership has grown by 15% over the past 10 years, from 1998, where we had 6 million people covered, to now, where we have 8 million. Even though there has been some growth, we believe that we could do much more if we could extend affordability and find ways in which we can reduce costs. What has driven the growth in the recent past is GEMS. The orange refers to GEMS, the implementation of GEMS and the growth that it has seen over the past few years. But there has been some growth of the uninsured. There has been medical schemes, including Discovery, that have introduced some low-income products into the market, and that has resulted in some previously uninsured people entering the market. And talking specifically about the Discovery products, which was launched 6 years ago, KeyCare, the left-hand side shows you the growth, the exponential growth that KeyCare has seen over the past few years. We now cover just over 300,000 lives in KeyCare. And the majority of the people who've joined KeyCare are previously uninsured. 63% of people who've joined KeyCare did not have access to private health care cover before, and as a result of joining KeyCare now, they have enjoyed the luxury of benefiting from private health care. So as I said, 53% were previously uninsured, and another 37% came from other Medicare schemes. So we believe that this has been a significant success story as far as the extension of cover to previously uninsured. So just how we did that is that we brought together various role players, and each one contributed somewhat towards the development of KeyCare in terms of discounts. So administration company, which is Discovery Health, P2I, discounted its fees, its average its admin fee by 40% to 50%. The hospitals gave us a discount of between 7% to 10%. The healthcare professionals, various healthcare professionals, gave us discounts of between 15% and 45%, and the brokers also took a discount of between 40% and 60%. And as you can see, because of all the discounts that we're able to get from the various role players, we're able to launch a product which is 412 for the lowest income band. So KeyCare is the premiums are set by income band. The lowest income band is below 3,500, and a person who's in that income band pays about 412 fares, and we like to say that that's an equivalent of the Coke Light per day. So we believe that that's a lot of value add for quite an affordable premium. If you especially look at the benefits in which a person can be able to get out of KeyCare. So that's one of the supposed significant achievements over the past few years. So Johnny will take over now from the regulatory challenges as well as the business model and the operating model for Discovery Health.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we appreciate your kind attention. I wanted to give some information to the honourable members of the committee on some of the challenges that medical schemes are currently facing as a result of the regulatory environment. We're all aware, of course, of the important discussions and debates regarding a proposed national health insurance system for the country. And I think the point we would like to impress upon you is that while that important debate is continuing, there are additional elements of regulation and legislation that are required to stabilize and enhance the medical scheme system. You may know that many medical schemes out there are struggling because they have high proportions of members who are pensioners or have chronic conditions. So in our language, in our jargon, we would describe those schemes as having very poor risk pools. And you have, on the other hand, some that have better risk pools. A good example of that would be GEMS, where the average age is very young. And a situation where some schemes have a very a poor risk pool and some a very good one is not a fair system, because the schemes with poor risk pools have then very high premiums in order to sustain themselves, and those with better risk profiles can afford lower premiums. The solution to this is what's called a risk equalization fund, which shares out the risk between all the different medical schemes. This was mooted and, in fact, was debated in this Parliament about 2 years ago, we would certainly impress on the honourable members the importance of revisiting this important piece of legislation. My colleague Penny mentioned the fact that medical schemes are required to cover these prescribed minimum benefits. One of the difficulties with those is that they make the cost of entry into medical schemes very high. Even though we're able to offer KeyCare products at 400 rand per person per month, for a family of three or four, that is still a lot of money, and that can consume a high proportion of family disposable income. And so we would, again, encourage some discussion about whether exemptions could be made for schemes catering for low-income working-class families to be exempted to some extent from the prescribed minimum benefits. Again, we believe that but that's an important consideration. I want to also mention the problem of anti-selection. This is, again, forgive the technical term. This is a term that refers to a process in which people join medical schemes when they need to, when they expect to claim significantly. But medical schemes only really work in the long term if people join when they're young and healthy. pay in for quite a long time and then claim when they become sick. If you join a medical scheme just when you need to claim and then you leave afterwards, which often happens, medical schemes can't sustain themselves. So a classic example of that would be maternity. We see many schemes that we're looking after struggling because young married families join just as they're planning to have a baby. They have their baby in a private hospital that can cost between 15 and 25,000 rand for a delivery, and then they leave. Now, during that time, they will have contributed far less than 15 to 25,000 rand, and you just think through it. Medical scheme can't work like that. I'd like to take you briefly back to the slide my colleague Penny showed earlier, which shows this slide, which shows the increasing number of people with chronic disease on the left of your screen and the increasing number of people with HIV and cancer on your right over the last 5 years. That's a dramatic increase. And this is in the Discovery Health Medical Scheme. Now, this is partly driven by anti-selection. When people learn that they have HIV, they join a medical scheme because they get fantastic cover, all of the antiretrovirals covered in full, all consultations and so on. And the medical scheme by law must accept them and must cover them. And that's a good thing. I mean, we're not saying that the law around open enrollment and so on is, but the medical schemes need some protection from this problem of anti-selection. And again, the risk equalization is one mechanism for that. And another, which was supposed to be implemented at the around the same time as the open enrollment, is mandatory cover. The idea was that all people who have formal jobs would be required to belong to a medical scheme. And the difficulty medical schemes face today, and one of the reasons for the increase in costs, is that some parts of the legislation were implemented, but others were left out. So the parts that mean a medical scheme must accept anybody was implemented, but compulsory cover was not. And if you look around the world, all over Europe and other countries which have national health insurance or other systems, where the medical schemes are forced to accept anybody, there's also compulsory membership. You can't really have the one with the other without bankrupting medical schemes in the long term. I'm just going to get back to where I was, if you'll excuse me for a minute. I'm going to now, at the request of the committee, talk a little bit about Discovery Health's business and operating models. You asked us to explain to the committee what services are provided to medical schemes. I just, as I mentioned at the outset, Mr. Chair, this shows you Discovery Health in the middle as the administrator. And as I said, we provide administration and management services for a total of 15 medical schemes. The one on the right is the Discovery Health Medical Scheme, represented today by my colleague, Mr. Milton Streak, who's the principal officer. That is the largest open medical scheme in the market. It has 2.1 million lives. About 44% of the open scheme market is in that one scheme. And we also provide services for 14 restricted schemes. These are, as my colleague Penny mentioned, schemes that are limited to one employer or group of employers. So you'll see an example there of Lonmin at the top in the middle. You're all aware of Lonmin, the mining company. It has its own medical scheme, and we provide the management services for that scheme. And there are 14 others as well. We bring to this job of managing and administering these schemes a number of assets and approaches. They involve, firstly, on the left, the design of the benefits of the plan, and those often change from 1 year to another. A significant number of risk management tools, which I will describe, and then a number of other assets in the healthcare system that we have developed, including negotiation of favorable tariffs with hospitals and doctors, selection of networks of hospitals, selection of networks of specialists and pathology groups, and other networks in the environment. I want to give you a little bit of a flavor for the scale of the Discovery Health operation. I think people are often not sure what medical schemes administrators and managed care organizations do and why it's necessary for a medical scheme member to pay an administration fee. If you look at the bottom, this gives you a sense of the number of people that that are employed in part of our operations, you know, in terms of both capturing of application forms and underwriting, call center consultants. We have about 600 of those, or in fact about 900 of those. We take nearly 34,000 calls every day from Discovery Health members. We bill to members 1.7 billion rand a month. We interact with employer groups about 20,000 times a month, and we have close to 5,000 of our members come into our offices every month to deal with their claims. In terms of managing the care that our members get, we authorize a hospital admission every 57 seconds, 24/7, 365 days a year. That's about 40,000 hospital admissions a month. A baby is born to a Discovery member every 10 minutes. We process applications for chronic benefits 650 a day, and we deal with about 6,000 GPs and 5,000 specialists. And to do that, we employ a team of about 160 clinical specialists, including nurses, doctors, pharmacists, and other specialist consultants. And then we also process claims. We process 120,000 claims per day, and we pay out about 8 million rand per hour. Again, that is 24/7, 365 days a year. So this is a large operation. Altogether, we employ 3,300 people to service the 2.4 million lives that we take care of every day. We just to again put a few more statistics here. We collect a total of 28 billion rand per annum in premiums. We process new applications to join Discovery and our other medical schemes about 1,000 a day, every single day. We turn around our average claims in under 2 days. We also provide wellness and HIV testing and counseling to our employers and their employees. And we had about 12,000 of those during last year. This slide shows you that over time we're trying to become more and more efficient. So if you go back over the last 6 years, our average time 6 years ago to process and pay a claim was just over 2 days. We now have it well under half a day. So we turn around approximately 90% of our claims electronically, usually within a few hours. We also are trying to bring down our error rates, and we continuously survey our members on the quality of our services, which are shown in this slide. We've also been making significant efforts to bring down the administration fees to our members and to our medical scheme, and as we've grown and have become more efficient, what this slide shows you is that we've brought down the administration fee from 12% in 2005, and it is in 2010 it's 9.8%. So we've been dropping the administration fee. That fee has been rising at or below inflation, while premiums have been increasing at above inflation over the last 5 years. I want to talk a little bit about the assets and resources we deploy in managing the risk for the medical scheme. We have a number of units, a team of actuaries, a team of doctors and health economists, a team of clinical risk managers, and various other professionals. I think it's shown at the bottom there, 14 doctors, 21 actuaries, 6 pharmacists, 43 analysts, and 27 clinical specialists. Who do this work for us. And I want to share with you a few examples of this kind of work that is done in order to make medical scheme cover affordable. I'm going to start firstly with a little bit of work we've been doing on managing risk for members themselves, and I want to share with you some, I hope you'll find interesting statistics. If we analyze the Discovery Health Medical Scheme, these 2.1 million members, we find that about 2%, if you look at those top two triangles on this slide, about 2% of the members account for approximately 20% of the total cost of the medical scheme. So that is 2% of 2 million, it's about 20,000 people, 20,000 people out of 2.1 million who have complex illness, and they account for about 20% of the total expenditure of Discovery, about 3 billion. And so we've designed some programs to focus very carefully on those 20,000 people. One of the issues we've uncovered over the last few years is that many of these 20,000 people we call, are often in and out of hospital several times a year. They'll be, I'll give you an example of an old lady. She has diabetes. Her blood sugar is not well controlled. She gets dizzy, falls at home, breaks her hip. She's admitted to hospital. Her hip is repaired. She's then sent home. No one bothers to find out that her circumstances at home are difficult. She doesn't have a family to support her. She lives on the fourth floor of a block of flats. She falls again and injures herself, and she's back in hospital. And this kind of pattern happens all over our healthcare system. I think we're dealing in both the public and the private healthcare system with quite a fragmented environment. The GP doesn't talk to the specialist. That no one talks to the family. I'm sure many of you have had personal experiences of a family member in hospital. Several doctors are coming to see your family member. Nobody's talking to you. Nobody's talking to each other. And what Discovery has now implemented is a special program in which we have implemented care coordinators and special step-down facilities in the environment. And our coordinators work with the GPs, with the specialists. We send nurses into the home in order to provide better care for our patients. And this slide, I hope you all agree, shows very exciting results. What we found here is that if you look at this on the left, this is these are our members in the first year when they're admitted to hospital with heart failure. And if you look at the gold, in the first year, those members cost about 70,000 rand. But in the second year, that cost comes down to about 60,000, and that's because they probably didn't have as much hospital care in the second year as the first year. But if you look at the blue, these are the people that we enrolled in this coordinated care program. So they have the same severity of illness. In their first year, they cost even more, nearly 80,000. In the second year, that comes down by 58% to close to 30,000, because what we've done by sending nurses to their homes and working with them in the community is prevented one or two hospital admissions that could have been avoided. And you see a similar example here with stroke patients. The costs come down significantly by 49% for those who are enrolled in our programs. I want to talk a little bit about our management efforts with GPs and specialists. One of the things that we know is that not all doctors are the same. If you look at this graph, it shows you each of these dots is a GP looking after our key care patients. And what we've done here is use a very sophisticated analytic tools to compare the efficiency of each one of those GPs based on the quality of care they provide and the cost of that care. And so the GPs that are in blue along that horizontal line are at what we regard as an efficient level. Those in green are more efficient than their peers, but those in red are significantly less efficient. And so what we're working on is we've identified that about 5% of the doctors in the country look after about 2.7% of our key care patients, but they account for nearly 15% of the cost. So there are doctors out there who order many more laboratory tests than their peers, use more expensive medicines than their peers. And our approach to this is to identify them and then to go and have discussions with them. And we find very positive responses to this kind of work. This has taken Discovery probably 7 years of investment to to develop the technology that allows us to do these comparisons. Because if you go to a doctor and you say, you cost more than Dr. X down the road, he will say to you, but you don't understand my practice. I've got sicker patients. And so we need the ability to compare the practice of the one doctor with the other so that we're doing comparing apples with apples. We've also discovered that one significant cause of increase in cost in the healthcare environment is pathology, laboratory testing, and one of the things that we've done to try and address that is develop our own pathology request form. This has been done in collaboration with the major pathology laboratories. What this does is, firstly, it's very small writing, I apologize, but on your own printout, you'll see on that form it shows the prices of each laboratory test. We talk to doctors and they tell us, thank you for showing us this. We never knew that when we tick all those boxes, we're generating 2,000 or 3,000 rands worth of cost for the member and the medical scheme. And we're now thinking a little more carefully about which boxes we tick. In addition, what we've done is on the existing forms designed by the laboratory, I'll give you an example. There's a test for cholesterol. If you use the standard laboratory form, it uses the word lipogram. Now, lipogram actually consists of four separate tests. But on our form, you need to tick each of those four tests separately if the doctor truly wants them. Because actually, you only need one of them, the total cholesterol, and if that is increased, you can then order the other three. And so we've implemented this form. I want to show you a few results. We found already in January and February of 2010, compared to last year, that these tests for cholesterol, there's already a saving of about 7 million rand to Discovery Medical Scheme because the doctors are being more selective in ordering those tests. And similarly with thyroid tests, a saving probably of 6 million rand. So just between those two tests, a saving of 13 million, just through doctors ordering their pathology a little more carefully. One of the big concerns, I know it was a concern of your committee that motivated these discussions, is that members of medical schemes pay premiums, but they also face co-payments. They have to pay cash out of pocket when they visit doctors and hospitals. One of Discovery's big drives in the last few years has been to sign up contracts with doctors in the environment in order that our members have no co-payments. And what this slide shows is that as of 2010, we have about 87% of GPs in the country who have signed contracts with Discovery, and if our members go to any one of those GPs, there will be no co-payments whatsoever. So we don't tell our members where to go. We say these 87% have made an agreement with us. You can go there and you'll have no co-payment. You are free to go to one of the other 13%. You are likely to face a co-payment there. So obviously we like to give members choice, but to give them the protection and the opportunity of no co-payment. And we believe 87% is a very good proportion of doctors who are willing to charge only the Discovery rate and no co-payment. Similarly, with specialists, what this shows is that by March of this year, 87% of all our members' consultations with specialists were at a specialist who's contracted with Discovery not to charge more than what the medical scheme will pay. Once again, our members are free to choose, and many of them choose to go to a specialist who will charge more than the scheme will pay, but at least that's the member's choice. And we're giving our members the opportunity to attend specialists where there is no co-payment. Finally, a little bit about hospitals. You know, we have discovered areas where there is significant increases in hospital admissions. One problem is back surgery and back pain. We've worked with the specialist to develop the appropriate clinical protocols, and when we implement those, we find the rate of admissions for these conditions comes down significantly. We also analyze hospitals like we do the doctors, and each of these dots represents a hospital. What you can see there, that line at the if you look along the vertical axis, one represents efficiency. So if you're below that, you're more efficient, and if you're above that, you're less efficient. And so just to give you a feeling here, if you look at Hospital A at the bottom and Hospital J, these are some of our most efficient hospitals. The average hospital admission in the Discovery environment this year is probably costing approximately 16,000 Rand on average. Now that can range from 3 or 4,000 up to 6 million. So you know, we have many of our members who, for whom the scheme pays many millions of Rand for their hospital admission. The average is 16,000. But what that shows you is that the Hospital A is operating at an average cost probably of about 6,500. So it's much more efficient. But if you look at the circle on the top left, you have hospitals there operating at an average cost of close to 40,000. So they're much less efficient. And what Discovery does is build our hospital networks and direct our members to the more efficient hospitals. I want to also share with you some of the work we do to investigate fraud and abuse in the healthcare environment. One example we picked up during the course of last year was we were getting claims, many claims over many months from biokineticists for what seemed to be very long-duration, persistent back and neck and shoulder problems for our members. We investigated this. We discovered that quite a number of these biokineticists were actually claiming from the medical scheme for personal training. They're providing personal training to members and claiming for the treatment of back or shoulder problems. We went to talk to their society. And if you look at that red line, at that gold line, you know, literally immediately after we made that interaction, the number of those claims dropped out almost completely, and that problem has now been dealt with. A similar example, we discovered that some radiology practices were charging the medical scheme for very expensive gloves that they were using on every single x-ray. We went to speak to them. You know, they didn't challenge us immediately. The claims are dropped off, and we're no longer paying for those. So that was where the intervention was done. We also pick up errors, and it's important that medical scheme administrators have systems to pick up errors. So here's an example where our system compares in real time the claims we get from the anaesthetist and from the hospital. So if a member of ours goes to hospital for their tonsils out, we get one claim from the anaesthetist and one claim from the hospital, and we compare those. So here you see an example where the anaesthetist billed us for a 40-minute procedure, but the hospital billed us for 1,401 minutes. Now, that is presumably an error, but because we're receiving 120,000 claims a day, those claims come in electronically and they go out often within seconds. They get paid. So you need automatic systems that also pick up these errors. And this is an error that was worth 106,000. And that obviously immediately gets recovered from the hospital and paid back to the medical scheme. We estimate conservatively that in 2009, these risk management activities saved the Discovery Health Medical Scheme approximately 1.2 billion Rand. So that's a conservative estimate. It's probably more than that. And that is probably over 200% of the amount of fees that are paid by the scheme to Discovery to do this risk management activity. So I'd like to thank you all very much, Mr. Chair. I think we've kept within your time requirement of 40 minutes. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Doctor. We would like to thank you to present to us. I think you said more than 10 minutes, nearly. Now, we've got another 20 minutes now for discussion, where we will ask, allow the members to ask questions and response from you. It's now over to the honorable members. Any clarity-seeking questions, more information you want?
Thanks, Jefferson. What I want to...
Sorry.
Check in, don't use yourself, honorable member.
Okay, I'm Papi Khanara. I'm from the Portfolio Committee. There is something which I wanted this discovery to give us information on. Whether they have got any education program for their members in terms of their rights and involving health education. The other question will be, when they talk about this risk equalization, can they tell us more about how do they see it implemented and managed? And the whether this list concerning the doctors who have agreed to sign the non-co-payment agreement with you, whether it's available for only your members or for whether you can share that information with the members of this committee.
Thank you. Now, members, Honourable Morey.
Thank you, Chair. On one of the slides, unfortunately, that they are not numbered. I'm just asking in connection with the NHI, whether you, I mean, as a company, when it was introduced, do you see it as either a challenge or an opportunity? And whatever, however you answer it, maybe just explain to us if you think it's a challenge, you know. Just tell us further. And then I had another question on the members still paying something, but that was answered with the 86% where you've contracted with people. And then, yeah, I have a concern also on the affordability. But, yeah, that and there you've answered as you go along. And then on this, there's a slide where you have the chronic registered lives per 1,000 and the HIV and the cancerous patients. There's a decline on the chronic graph. I think it's along between 2005, 2006, and somewhere 2009, 2010. I'm not sure what are the cause of the decline, but I'm not, actually I just want to know from the scheme if you've done some research or something to check what happened specifically during those points when you get that peak decline and then immediately everything goes up. And my last question is on the key care, what is it, how does it differ from the normal health care that we have, and particularly on the slides where you have this one, I'm not sure what page is it. I just want to know, on top you say Discovery is focusing strongly on growing low income coverage, so to me I thought, okay, key care is only for the low earners or something, so if you can explain the difference between the two. Thank you very much.
I'm Emma More.
Sorry.
Okay. I think I mentioned your name, Honorable Member. I helped you there. Honorable Dubé, then Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenter. My name is Molebofe, preferably Gray, because it's very short. The name is Dubé. I'm the member of the Portfolio Committee. Every time when I start talking, I tell people that I'm a patient. For sure, a lot of people have observed it. So don't mind my questions if they are not in line with the doctors and nurses. I'm representing the patient. I want to know about the open scheme. When you spoke about it, it brought something to my mind that I must ask this question. To me, because it's not known to us, when did you start it, and how do you popularize it? And maybe along the discussions, somewhere, somehow, it was partly answered as to how do you determine who pays what? And the people who earn lower than, you know, we have all these people who are our domestic workers, our farm workers, who earn so little, are they, can they be covered in the scheme? And maybe the people who default on the process, like I'm employed today, I'm not, what happens if I can speak, whereas I've paid for the past 10 years? And also, it also brought back something in my mind when I was seeing a graph of you saying a lot of people are joining it. I just want to check who joins it, because if a person is self-employed, can they join that scheme? And also the question that the Honorable Moore has asked, the key care, what is it? And how many, no, which hospitals? I've heard you saying there are hospitals that Discovery is dealing with. Maybe if we can be provided with this. And maybe on the second round, let me not take all the questions, but I still have 2, 3, 4 questions and leave it there.
Honorable Member, I'm not sure whether we'll have a second opportunity.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You can continue.
Okay, with my question. All right. Also, the thing that, you know, strikes my mind is when you said you are employing doctors and nurses, what is it that they are doing? The patients, that you say, since you started visiting these patients at home, I want to check which areas are you concentrating on. Is it rural, urban, suburbs, township? And the last point is the fraudulent part of it. Does Discovery have a policy that says if a person has fraudulently acquired money, then legal action can be taken? Because to us, fraud, corruption is rising. So we cannot just afford to say, bring back my money and leave the patient and the person there. What is it that you do legally to stop the fraud and corruption? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. Honorable Khalid Swai.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson has already said my name, my surname is Khalid Swai, and I'm the member of this committee. Some question has been asked, but maybe I will just expand. Like when you talk, I always say that when we fought about parity, people thought that you were only fighting for money, for the salary. But what we were fighting for, we were saying that what is happening in Cape Town must happen in Swartland. There you find that those things, there's still a discrepancy, there's still difference. Like you are saying that the co-payment, I don't know if the co-payment, I understand it the way you said it, because you find that when I go to the hospital, for me to take a medical aid, I take medical aid knowing that when I'm ill, I may not have money. But you still find that in certain places, I have to pop up something to be seen, and of which I don't even have. And it is worse whereby I'm from a rural place, and there is no doctor from that place. I have to move from where I am, like if I move from Malatedi next to the Durbanburg border to Swartland, I use some money. But when you get to the doctor before you are seen, you have to pay something. When you go to the dispensary, before you get your medication, you pay something. Then I want us like to talk about that. Another thing is you said that medical scheme, it is advisable for the people to join medical scheme while they are still young and they are not ill. Now I want to know if that is the case. If I joined medical aid when I was still young and not sick, then now I'm 60 and I don't have money, and my medical I was working whereby I cannot have advantage of continuing with the medical aid. Do you look at those years which I didn't use whatever I contributed, because it happens that for a year I may not go to the doctor? Do you look at those things, or you just cut me out because I'm no more having money? The issue of fraud. I think sitting here, me and you, you are aware that there are still doctors who are dispensing within their examination room, but they don't put aspirin, whatever. They put those things as procedures at the end of the day. I want to know, are you aware of that, and what are you doing? Because with me, at my level, it may not happen. But if for majority of our people who have medical aid, who goes to those doctors, who will be examining them and prescribing antibiotics and giving them from their examination room, and put something else as a procedure, knowing that according to law they are not supposed to dispense. Have you ever seen those things? Can you still elaborate on integrated units, care units? Because really, if you can look at your medical aid bill, or the hospital bill, whereby you find that a swab, PrEP swab is 100 and something, a small PrEP, all those things. I want you to elaborate. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think I'll allow the last two members to just give it brief, make it brief, please, Honourable Walker.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Mike Waters, and thanks for the presentation. We'll keep it brief. I just wanted to know about the home-based care program that you got, which has reduced costs quite dramatically. When you gave us the slide that showed the decline in the cost, did that include the cost of hiring the nurses to go to the homes as well, or was it just the actual cost from the hospital saving side? If you can give us more clarity on that. And as far as the risk equalization fund is concerned and compulsory membership for all workers, have you engaged government in retabling the risk equalization fund legislation at all, and what's the response been? And also your views on, because currently the private sector pays 14% VAT on all medicines while the public sector doesn't. I mean, that's also another driving factor of costs, and whether you've engaged government on that. And then just also on your key care program, which is quite encouraging. I mean, what are the you say you've got to the key care program adheres to all the prescribing benefits. I mean, so you rightfully said that 412 rand a month is a lot per member for someone earning 2,000 or 3,000 rand. I mean, it's a huge chunk. So in your proposals, where you would like government to maybe have different minimum prescribed benefits depending on which package and how much you earn, what benefits are you looking at for the lower end of the market then? Because one of the arguments against having low packages has been the fact that people's benefits will run out from their hospital and will be transferred over to a state hospital and they'll be dumped on the state. I mean, if you can just elaborate on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Walters. Honourable Zhao will be the last member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've not many questions. Doctor, I'd like to know Discovery Health and Discovery, is it the same medical aid? For me asking that, because I was in Discovery Health, and after that I heard Discovery is another medical aid. And then further, I'd like also to know the day-to-day account that you have with the members. How did a member know this is for day-to-day, this is to seeing a doctor? Because I was a member of Discovery, and I experienced a lot of frustrations in this regard. And that's why maybe they dropped down from 2005 to 2006. It was in the time when all of us in the municipalities had to move to another scheme because we faced difficulties with exactly Discovery Health. The agreement that you signed with the doctors, that was at that time one of the major problems we have, because we have one doctor in the area, and when you go there, he said, Discovery didn't pay for that. So now you have to pay first, and then you can claim a Discovery. And that's not the reason why we are in a medical aid then. You are in a medical aid when you go sick, so that you can go to the doctor, and that he can see oversee you with and he will claim his bill from the medical aid. And really, every time a medical aid comes and sits before us, I say, I don't want to listen, because they tell us some more things, and then when you start to use the medical aid, the people said, no, I didn't say that, you understand that, and you didn't explain it like that, and all that kind of things. But they gave us documents, lots of documents, but the fine print is also a problem. So can you please explain that to me?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think we are running out of time. Always, time is always a problem. So you've got 10 minutes left for responses. I do believe that some of these questions do cut across all the medical schemes. So I hope the other medicines are listening also, maybe. If they do their presentation, they can maybe listen to that. I'll hand over to you, Dr. Bumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Honourable Members, for a very long and challenging list of questions. I'll do my best to answer them swiftly. And if you'll permit me, Mr. Chair, I won't necessarily answer for each member's questions. I may try and group them together. Member Khanare asked about whether we have education program around members' rights and health education. We make great efforts on both of those. In terms of members' rights, we provide our members every year with a detailed brochure on their benefits and their and how to access those. We have a website which is full of information. We send out a magazine 4 times a year to our 2.1 million members. So we do make a significant effort to educate members on their rights and their benefits. It is a complicated environment, and I think we have to acknowledge that. In terms of health education, we like to believe that Discovery is a world leader with its Vitality program in this regard. We invest huge amounts of money and effort in educating our members about keeping healthy, about exercise, eating well, and so on. That makes a very big impact on the claims in the medical scheme and on the affordability and on the survival of our members. So we do believe that's a critical thing for medical schemes to do. The member also asked about the risk equalization, and I'll address that at the same time as the question from Honourable Member Mr. Waters. A lot of work has been done by the Council for Medical Schemes on the mechanics of a risk equalization fund, a huge amount. For several years, there's been a technical team working, and as I said, there was draft legislation that came before the House, I believe, and ultimately wasn't taken into the process. I think that was probably sometime in early 2008 that process sort of fell by the wayside. So I mean, it is a complicated issue, but in a nutshell, what would happen is that the Council for Medical Schemes would create a central fund, almost a bank account. Every scheme would pay in a fixed amount per month for each member of the scheme to that bank account. Then those schemes that had a very high risk would receive a further payout from the fund. And what that would mean is they would be compensated for their high risk. And so it's almost kind of like a progressive tax system. So, for example, a scheme with very low risk would end up paying in, and a scheme with high risk members would receive money from the fund, and it would therefore be able to charge lower premiums, or at least similar premiums. So this is not a uniquely South African proposal. There are many European countries that have been operating risk equalization funds for many years. But, you know, we would encourage this committee to reintroduce that debate, if at all possible. The member also asked about our contracts with GPs and specialists and whether those lists are available. So I think, firstly, on our website, it's possible for Discovery members to find out when any suburb they live in, any kind of doctor they want to see, whether that doctor charges according to the scheme rates or more, and so on. Unfortunately, we cannot sign contracts with doctors for members of other medical schemes. So if you belong to another medical scheme, that's up to a discussion between the doctor and the other medical scheme. But I want to reflect on the comments made by the last member around the frustrations with doctors. We're very aware that back in 2005 and 2006, when we started this process, it was difficult. Many doctors, were somewhat resistant to the idea of contracting with medical schemes. We've now been working very hard with them, and as I said, by now, we have close to 90% of doctors that are signed contracts with us. So it is, of course, possible that if members are unaware, they will encounter a doctor who still charges a copayment. And we do make efforts to encourage and educate our members, but if you consider how many times our members engage with the healthcare system every day, at the end of the day, members also have to educate themselves in order to prevent the copayments, because the members don't call us before they go and see a GP or a specialist. They send us the claim afterwards. So we don't have an opportunity to warn them every time, go to this doctor or go to that doctor. So it is a balance of us providing information and encouraging members to find their own. Honourable member asked about the national health insurance and whether at Discovery we see this as a challenge and an opportunity. We believe that this debate about health reform is vital for the country. Our healthcare system is in need of reform. We need to improve the functioning of the public system and the private system. And we need, most importantly, to improve the way those two healthcare systems work together. So we believe that within the context of a national health insurance system, medical schemes will continue to play a vital role. And so we see ourselves working strongly in collaboration with the Department of Health to implement the health reforms. We see that we'll continue to play a role afterwards. We have great expertise and resources that could assist the implementation of an NHI in due course. So I think we would see it as both a challenge and an opportunity to work with the emerging national health insurance system. I'm going to ask at the end of my addressing the questions, Penny, to talk about key care. There were a number of questions about key care. Perhaps you can deal with all of those. I'll just try and get through the rest quickly. The Honourable Dube asked about when the open medical scheme discovery was started. It was in 1992. How is it publicised? It is, publicised through a number of different mechanisms, marketing and advertising, but in the main, brokers. There are many thousands of individual and corporate brokers that talk to companies and to individuals and give them advice. These are accredited, registered brokers, and they give advice to clients about what medical scheme to join. So that's the main form of publicity. You asked how we determine who pays what. into the medical scheme. Within Discovery, and our colleagues from the other schemes will tell you similar, each medical scheme has a number of different plans or benefits options. So in Discovery, as of 2010, there are 13 different option choices. So from the most comprehensive cover, we call an executive plan, and then KeyCare, which offers a more restricted cover. And the premiums for those will vary from around 400 Rand, as Penny says, at the lower end of KeyCare, you know, up to 3,000 Rand for a single person at the very top end option, but then you're getting much more comprehensive benefits. All of those benefits are compliant with the prescribed minimum benefits legislation, but they just offer different and additional benefits. One example would be for cancer treatment. If you're in our top plans, you have you know, a very, very significant amount of funding available for cancer treatment. In fact, it's unlimited funding for cancer treatment. Whereas at some of the lower cost plans, there will be more restrictions on that. Penny will talk about the key care hospitals. You asked what our nurses and doctors do, the ones that we employ. They do a number of things that help to manage the cost of the claims that are coming into the medical scheme. So that all of the work I showed you around identifying fraud, identifying which doctors are more efficient, which are less, which hospitals are more, these are done by teams of actuaries, doctors, and nurses. When a new drug is brought into South Africa, we have a team of people that looks at the cost of that medicine, how effective it is, and we negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies to try and bring down the price. Because of single exit price legislation, that price will then apply for the whole country, not for Discovery members. But we use our expertise to try and bring down the price of those drugs. So our doctors and nurses and economists do a very wide range of things generally that are about trying to bring down the cost of treatment and therefore keep premiums more affordable. You asked where we are doing the work in the coordinated care unit for these very high-cost sick members. For 2 years, we've been running a pilot program in the Western Cape, and it is unfortunately not in rural areas, and it's not particularly focused in the townships. It is in the areas where most of our members in the Western Cape you know, are, and around the major hospitals. So this is sort of in the northern and southern suburbs of the Western Cape. Of Cape Town. We're now rolling that program out to all the major metropolitan centers, so Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, Port Elizabeth, and East London over the next 2 years. In answer to the Honorable Waters' question about the cost of that, those savings are purely claim savings. They aren't net of the increased cost. The increased cost is very small compared to the scale of the expenditure on hospitalization. So we're very comfortable that the return on the increased cost will be very, very significant. You also asked Honorable Dube on our policy when we encounter fraud. We have a very active forensics and fraud unit. We have two approaches when we encounter fraud. The one is we must try and recover the money for the members of the medical scheme. That's a priority, and we do that. Where there is clear fraud, we report the individuals involved if they are a health professional to the Health Professions Council, and also when there's clear-cut case of fraud to the police. So we do take all of those actions. You know, a key priority, however, is to recover the money for the members of the scheme. Honourable Member Khaladi Tswai, you asked about co-payments. There's no doubt that there are still members of medical schemes who encounter co-payments. I think we wouldn't deny that. There are doctors who charge more than the scheme contracted rates, and there are many medical schemes. This is not the case for Discovery, but many medical schemes who haven't contracted with doctors. So those schemes simply say, we pay a scheme rate, a tariff, and if whatever the doctor charges, the member will have to pay the difference. And I think, to be honest with you, that's probably the majority of medical schemes don't have contracted agreements with doctors and hospitals. And that is, I think, where a lot of the complaints come from. You asked, I think, a very important question about the problem of you contribute when you're young. You may claim much less than you contribute. And then let's say if you're older and you're a pensioner and you can't afford to pay in anymore, what happens to you? I think the what happens at that point is, unfortunately, unless you're with an employer who continues to fund your medical scheme contribution after you retire, if you cannot continue to pay for it yourself, you no longer are a member of the medical scheme. And the reason for that is that medical schemes do fund themselves on a, you know, what we would call a pay-as-you-go basis. So in every year, the medical scheme is just breaking even. It's paying out claims and collecting premiums that just balance out. So even though you, as a young, healthy person in 2010, you claimed much less than you paid, there were many other people who claimed, you know, 100 times more than they paid in that year. You're paying for them. And, you know, and but heaven forbid if, you know, somebody in one of our families had a terrible accident, they'd be paying for us. But it does work year by year. So there isn't pre-funding for you that when you paid in all those years, there isn't a system where you can now be guaranteed continuation membership yourself. There was also a question about dispensing and are we aware of fraud in that area. We are. We work very hard on it. We do believe that the vast majority of doctors and other health professionals in our country are honest, but there is a small minority where there is fraud and abuse, and we do try and identify that wherever we can and crack down. We also need our members to help us identify that because they need to be our eyes and ears. Honourable Waters, I've answered on the both, I think, the risk equalisation and the home-based care. On the risk equalisation, you asked about about our engagement with the Department of Health. I think, to be honest, in the period since 2008, we have tried to engage on risk equalisation and compulsory membership. It does seem now that there is increasing engagement with that, and you know we're very encouraged that hopefully this discussion can come back onto the agenda. You asked about the alternative for PMBs for low-income households. Yeah. This, we believe, is a critical area. We believe that, firstly, there could be a version of prescribed minimum benefits that covered some element of both out-of-hospital and in-hospital cost and benefits. We believe that that could be done probably for under 200 rand a month if there were changes to the law. And we believe that one could do that without ending up with members running out of benefits and being transferred to public facilities. And that would require some changes to the way hospitals deliver care. I think we need some changes to the law to allow hospitals to employ doctors. You may know that the regulations of the Health Professions Council prevent that. We think that's not rational. If you look at how the mine hospitals work, they provide brilliant, efficient, high-quality care because they employ doctors, and the doctors are then able to focus on quality, you know, not on doing more fee-for-service. So there are ways to change the delivery in order to provide low-cost, you know, quality of care. Our concern around the prescribed minimum benefits is that while the intention of that law is undoubtedly a good one, the unintended consequence is that it keeps out of medical cover, you know, low-income families and their dependents, and it's unfair because they don't get the tax subsidy, and they don't benefit from an employer subsidy because they cannot afford their part of the premium. So it is an unfair, it's an unintended consequence of the prescribed minimum benefits legislation. And again, you know, we would be delighted if that could come back onto the discussion. There was also some questions about Discovery Health and Discovery. Are they the same? I think we tried to show on one of our early slides that there is the Discovery Health Medical Scheme. That is an open scheme. It's open to any member of the public. It has 2.1 million members, and anyone can join. And it is administered by Discovery Health, which is the administrator which employs, and I'm an employee of that business. So there's Discovery Health Medical Scheme, and then there's the administrator. Perhaps I can just go back to that slide very quickly. It's actually further. I think it's further down. No, it's actually right down. I'll go there. So you have in blue the administrator and then the scheme at the top. And as I also mentioned, Discovery Health provides services for 14 other schemes as well. You asked, I think, an important question about the day-to-day account and how do members know what is for the day-to-day account. I think that is, again, an important issue. We try and educate our members with through the website, through brochures, through booklets, and brokers are also paid to educate members. We try and help employers to educate members. The general principle is that most services, most healthcare services that you get when you're not in hospital usually come from the day-to-day account. For example, if you visit a GP or a dentist or a physiotherapist, would come from the day-to-day account. However, some of those services, if they are for prescribed minimum benefits, will come from the scheme's risk pool. So if you are registered with us for diabetes, your GP visits and your medicine would come from, not from your day-to-day account. And so it is confusing, and I think it is, the medical schemes environment is confusing for ordinary people. My wife always tells me that I've been working for Discovery for 7 years, and I talk about this every day, and she doesn't understand how the medical scheme works. So, Penny, if you could handle the key kit question.
The question that was posed was, what is key care and how does it work? And of course, there was a question around the number of hospitals and where, if we can give you a list of those private hospitals. KeyCare is an option. Johnny said earlier that we have 13 mm-hmm. options within the Discovery Health Medical Scheme. So it's one option within the Discovery Health Medical Scheme. It's an option aimed specifically, it was launched 7 years ago, specifically at the low-income population, especially at the people who are what we call previously uninsured. As I showed you in one of the slides, 63% of the people who are joining KeyCare today have not had medical cover before. So it is aimed specifically at the previously uninsured population. In terms of the benefits, that how we manage to keep the premiums low is, firstly, I showed you a slide where all the different role players gave a discount. So the administrators gave, which is Discovery Health Medical Administrator, gave a discount in terms of the admin fees. The doctors came to the party in terms of the professional fees that they charge, the brokers, as well as all the different role players came in, the hospitals in particular, also gave a discount of between 7 and 10%. So this was the first way in which we were able to reduce the premiums. And the reason why all the different role players agreed to give a discount is because of the fact that the majority of the people on this plan are previously uninsured. So they are trying to extend cover to the previously uninsured. But the second way in which we managed to keep the premiums down is we carefully select a network of doctors, so it's doctors who have proven to us that they are able to administer care in an efficient way. So the doctors are carefully selected. We have 3,000 doctors in the network. The hospitals also are carefully selected using our efficiency rating index. We have 117 private hospitals, and those are also carefully chosen. Like I said, they give a discount, but also it's hospitals in the right area, but are also efficient. So that's how we managed to keep the premiums down. And we now currently have more than 300,000 people on this plan, and it is growing, it is appealing. In terms of the premiums, we differentiate the premiums by income. So people who earn below 3,500 rand, like I showed you, for a single person pays 412 rand, up to people who earn above 7,500 rand, and the premium is higher for those kinds of people. So that's the story. And around member education, it remains a challenge. It's something that we continuously try to improve. but it is quite difficult to get people to read because until they need to. So it's something that we focus on, and we try to improve every day to make sure that people understand their benefits. They know their doctors, they know the hospitals, and they know how to navigate the system.
Thank you, Dr. Penny and Dr. Jonathan. I do believe you got much more questions, but time. So, but in future, we'll meet again. Thank you for your presentation. I really do appreciate and your comprehensive answers. I think the members are satisfied with that. You may stay if you want to, listen to the other presentations, but if you want to go, you can go. All depends on you. I'll ask Bonita now, Honorable. So we are running behind now, 10 minutes already, half past now. I hope Bonita will save us some time. You've got according to the program, you've got an hour. Maybe we can do it in 40 minutes. Over to you, sir. Honourable members, I think while so busy there, we'll be having a short break after this presentation, say for 10 minutes or so, after Bonitas. But if you want to like to have some tea, feel free to go and have some tea or something to drink and come back again. Rachel, over to you. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, and good morning again. My name is Gerard van Emmenes. I'm the acting principal officer of Bonitas Medical Fund. Perhaps just being the middle presentation of this session, my presentation may suffer from the middle child syndrome. Some of it will be repetitive, some of it will be new, and I'll try and leave my colleague some space to present after me as well. The different points that I'm going to address this morning is a bit of the history of Bonitas Medical Fund, just a snapshot of the financial overview, the options available that we provide to members, healthcare expenditure, the breakdown, and then just one slide on how we care for the sick. Then also address some of the challenges that we experience in the industry, the health-related legislation, the current medical schemes environment, and problem with optional membership. I think it has been exhausted to some degree, but I would like to make one or two other points on it. The legal environment, and then the problems that we experience with prescribed minimum benefit and the cost at the moment. Tariff increases, and then some practical issues. Mr. Chairman, I can assure you I'm not going to use all my time. so there would be enough time to ask questions. Perhaps some useless information or very useful information. Bonitas was established in 1982. Some of you may still recall from the previous regime that there was an attempt in the early 80s to develop a four-chamber parliament, one for whites, blacks, coloureds and Indians. And with that there was a medical scheme established for each of these different chambers of parliament. The one for the Indian people was called Sanitas. The one for colored people is still in existence. It's called Prasanu. The one for the white people at that stage was called Medihelp, or it's called today Medihelp. And then the one for the black employees of government were called Panitas. So we were originally established by this very own parliament 28 years ago. Currently, two-thirds of our membership are black. We've transformed ourselves as an open medical scheme, but we also pride ourselves that we operate in that specific environment and demographics of the country. We cover approximately 8% of all the medical scheme's lives, and it amounts to about 1.4% of the population. Current membership is about 270,000 members and 630,000 lives. Our administration is done by MedScheme. One of the previous questions specifically asked about Discovery and Discovery Health. We are also an independent scheme non-profit, and then we are administered by MedScheme. The year 2010, how does the volume or the extent of Bonitas Medical Fund look like? Our expected contributions is $6.8 billion. Our expected healthcare expenditure is $5.8 billion. And our reserves is $2 billion, which is 35%. The Medical Schemes Act requires 25% as a minimum level. We are 10% above that after building reserves over a very long period, very steadily. All the scheme's profits or surpluses are accrued to the fund and it belongs to members. This slide indicates the six options that Bonitas provide to its members. Perhaps as a point of departure that I would like to distinguish, we differ quite a bit from other medical schemes only in one specific area, and that is the day-to-day cover. In the day-to-day cover for about 86% of our members, we provide comprehensive benefits on which the scheme takes the risk. Maybe if I can just elaborate on that, most medical aid products today, options, have what they call a savings account. We refer to them as new generation medical schemes. So you have a portion of your contribution set aside in a savings account, which you then utilize for all day-to-day expenses, whether it's pharmaceutical expenses, doctors, sometimes pathology and other expenses. We take a risk on that for 86% of our members. So we provide them with a number of visits to the doctors. We provide them with a sub-limit amount for physiotherapy, for acute medicines. So we are at risk there. So it's there's quite a distinction between that. This design also assists a lot for members that they don't have to pay out of pocket when they go to the doctors. Maybe if you look at the two top options, which is called the standard and the primary option, you'll see next to it, it says traditional. It's the concept that I just referred to now, where we take the risk on behalf of members. Between the two options, that's traditional options, there's 86% of our lives covered on that. And there you get a sense of the contribution, the average contribution for those options. Then we have a bond safe. that is your typical new generation where you have cover for your major medical expenses like your chronic benefits and hospital with a savings account attached to that. The bond comprehensive, which is our top-end product, it's one that we were necessitated to implement in order to compete in big corporates, because the executives would also like to have an option that appeals and cover all their conditions, and trust me, they often suffer more from conditions than most people. The bond essential is only a hospital product where we just cover the major expense of members, and then we've got the bond cap option, which is very similar to the key product of Discovery, where it's a capitated environment. You'll see that there's quite a difference in contribution between us and the previous presenter, in the sense that it depends on your risk profile which you have. People claim more, they obviously your contributions will go up. What we experience of lately is that all low-cost options are severely under pressure. I think one of the previous presenters referred to it as that people learn to expect more as they become more educated and they become more used to. We specifically find this at the low end that it happens. Even with rigorous sort of control and management programs, that there is a higher expectation. There is unfortunately also a thing called provider-induced demand, where the treating practitioner would often stimulate a kind of a demand what is needed for treatment. Perhaps if I can at this point just allude to the fact, schemes in general have very good reserves, most schemes. So they sit on assets, which I think one must seriously consider at the point in time when we look at a reformed health care system in South Africa. There are assets that's been built up over many years that are there. But there's also over the past 2 years an alarming figure rising at the moment. In 2008, the medical schemes as an industry made a loss of just over 900 million. The unofficial number that has not been published yet indicated that in 2009 we're looking at a 2.8 billion rand loss for the industry as a whole. How do we spend the money that we collect from members? Hospitals is 38% of all hospital costs, of all costs, healthcare costs, 16% for medicine, 10% for pathology, 9% for specialist, another 9% for dental and optical, and 8% for general practitioners, and then the rest, like physiotherapy and orthopedics and those kind of things, are made up another 9%. How do we care for the sick and the ill in a medical scheme? We're all aware that it's a drive from government, a campaign, awareness campaign on HIV this year. We've been doing that for a number of years, and we are taking care of 35,000 HIV patients. Currently, 15,000 of these members or beneficiaries are receiving antiretrovirals. We pay for around 150,000 hospital admissions per annum. Around 115,000 patients have chronic conditions, of which the majority are Western lifestyle and aging type related conditions, which is high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and then clotting disorders. Perhaps if I can then move on to the legislative consideration in the medical scheme environment. it has already been pointed out that in 1998, open enrollment, community rating, and prescribed minimum benefits has been introduced. Then on hold is the Risk Equalization Fund, basic benefit package, which we are all hoping we will see to make it more accessible for people to join medical aids, and then also specifically low-income medical schemes. We also have the belief that a Risk Equalization Fund will help ironing out the very bad risk that some schemes may have. However, we believe that is almost like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic while it's sinking. There's a far bigger problem, and that is that more people should have access to quality health care. The National Health Amended Bill is currently on hold. There's a proposed bargaining framework to agree and set tariffs. And that creates perhaps at the moment the biggest problem, single challenge for medical schemes is that uncertainty that the provider can charge anything they want according to the interpretation of the specific circular from Council for Medical Schemes, while schemes are not in a position to foot that bill at that specific cost. So it's very difficult to find a middle ground, and I think a lot of members' frustration, I see it off lately more and more in the newspapers, and it's more and more addressed, is that the provider, the doctor, or the specialist will charge a specific fee, and the scheme has committed through its rules and through the way it announced its contributions for the next year on a different cost level. If we look at the medical schemes environment, about 8 million lives is covered. What is very significant is there's an annual contribution of 85 billion rand, and that was for 2009. Mr. Chairman, this is quite important in the sense that it's really an industry that carries a lot of money, and it has very few role players if you really take into account the number of role players. I'm not referring to the medical schemes. I'm referring to doctors, specialists, hospitals, as well as the medical schemes, all the role players as such. So we are taking care of a substantial amount of money in the economy, and there's only 8 million lives covered under. The total reserves of all medical schemes is about 27 billion rand. Claims increased consistently greater than CPI. This is also a very important point to make, is that as we go on, if there is not a serious reform or intervention, the gap between what you will pay for medical aid and by what inflation increase will widen every year. A lot has to do with frequency. A presenter pointed out aging, technology, all those things. They all fall under one umbrella, and that is the frequency. The cost for a medical scheme are made up by price times the utilization. So if you pin down the one, if you pin down price, it means that there's a likelihood that your frequency of using the same procedures or repeating the same procedures will happen. If you pin down utilization, the chances are very good that price will increase. So it's a very fine balance to try and manage those things down to more in line with CPI. We also need compulsory membership to widen this coverage. And perhaps to illustrate this, the best is if one look at the two graphs that I've put up there is the following. One can see over age how the risk on health of an individual increase. That's the average risk of an individual over a period of time for the two genders. You'll see that between 20 and 40, that females' risk increase significantly more than that of males, and it's purely because it's their reproductive years, and that's normally when they utilize the maternity benefits. At the bottom, one sees how people join and whether they stay with medical aids over their lifespan or whether they not, and one can see between the age of 20 and 35, especially the males, bail out of the industry. And that is the most productive economic sector of our country, is that the people between 20 and 35, and it's often at that point in time that they opt to leave medical schemes and rather take risk on their own health and then join later again. The legal environment has its own challenges. There's a court case which went in the favor of a specific insurer, which means that there are competition out there for medical schemes, but they're not competing on equal footing with the medical schemes. It is called gap cover. It's people that only cover certain complementary risk if they don't take risk from the first rand, and they do erode the ability of medical schemes to be stabilized and cover comprehensive risk at the moment. So you find a lot of the young people that would rather just take a gap cover or a product that will ensure when they have a big event that they will get some financial compensation of such an event. This, however, threatens medical schemes in general, because we still need the cross-subsidization to properly care for the lives that we're looking at. The problem with prescribed minimum benefits at cost at the moment is that it can never be the intention that a service provider can charge any rate and that schemes are obliged to cover that. If that is the case, our actuarial forecasts indicate that our cost will increase by 20 to 30%. That to be the case, one can envisage that on the long run, people will leave the medical schemes because of unaffordability. But for the immediate future, the uncertainty creates a lot of problems for the medical schemes, in the sense that we cannot budget properly and control costs properly within the control of the medical schemes. The issue is it's draining the resources, specifically the reserves, over a period of time, and we may find in the soon or near future that schemes may not be necessarily able to uphold the minimum levels of reserves. Tariff increases, the Competition Commission means no collective bargaining with providers. I would just like to mention that I think there's already a strong presence on the supply side. There's only three big hospital groups in this country, namely MediClinic, Life and Netcare, whereas you've seen that there's over 100 medical schemes, 30 of open schemes and 77 closed schemes. That already make the demand side very fragmented, so we are already not on an equal footing. I'm not going to elaborate too much on this. I know my colleague after me will discuss the fact that medical schemes are not per se necessary in competition, and I'll leave it at that. But it is a problem for us if we cannot negotiate. If I can illustrate it to you, of lately, Netcare has announced their financial results for 6 months, about in the last 2 weeks. It was noticeable that their CEO foresee a very positive outlook for the medical schemes, and I guess it's based on the reserves of the scheme and not necessarily on the operational losses of the last 2 years of schemes. And also what was interesting is, although their revenue increased by around between 9 and 10%, their profit margin kept on increasing to 14%, which was very interesting to note. Practical issues. Contributions increase need to be set by August each year. If we don't have a good sense of what the government is going to recommend as a guideline for the increases on the National Health Reference Price List, it makes it very difficult for us to budget. Perhaps to illustrate it to you, 3 months before the next year, medical schemes are obliged to indicate the increases and change in benefits to members. So members must have 3 months to contemplate and consider these changes and the increase in contributions. However, you may recall that in 2008, one of the previous ministers of health, Barbara Hogan, the Honourable Barbara Hogan, announced in December that year a substantial higher increase for the service provider. And that caught a lot of the medical schemes on the wrong foot, that they didn't budget sufficiently for the increases the next year. So it's a timing issue in this instance. I think it can be overcome, and we would like the Department of Health to look at this at some stage. Because we make assumptions, and we made specifically an assumption in the industry that year for 8.5% increase. And what transpired then eventually was 10.7%. It will assist a lot for the industry if those increases are happening around the middle of the year, that we can use that as one of the guidelines for our budgets the next year. And that, Mr. Chairman, is in summary my addition to this session.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gerrard and M. Menes, for the short presentation. You saved a lot of time. We really do appreciate it. I think we will take now a short break, say for 10, 15 minutes. Let's make it 15 minutes. Quarter past. We'll be back here, and then we'll start with the questions and the discussion on Bonita. Thank you.
Thank you.
feel a horror, horror then.
Remember, I told you, I thought I was joking.
No, you're not coughing, you look fantastic.
What is this?
It just records everything.
Huh?
It records everything. So
like, I'm thinking you are recording
when
now.
When that's on. Yeah.
When this thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, who's private? I will see you. That's
our.
Yeah, it's not parliamentary.
Yeah.
Your secrets are safe.
Secrets are never safe.
Yeah, they're safe.
Never.
Have you got his number? Have you got his number there? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Walters. We were just waiting on you.
Okay.
I think we can start now. Honorable members, the presenters are very short. I think we will also be very short. Be very short of our questions. Be brief with your questions, please. And let us limit us to questions per member, please. We will see if there's still time left, we'll give another round.
Mm-hmm.
Let us just, and the most important questions. I don't want to actually limit you, you see. I want you to be free to ask the questions. But if it's possible, due to the time constraints. Honorable members, it's over to you now. I see the hands of Honorable Kinea, Fare, Walters, in that order, and Sikhoel Desai. The fourth. Yeah, thank you. Honorable Kinea.
Thank you, Sir Vincent. Thank you for the presentation. No worries that you have limited us. But I'm trying to be brief because I had four questions. But I think I'll try to be brief so that they are all accommodated. Thank you. Firstly, this numbering is a problem to us because you can't refer to the slide you want to take. Really, we plead that the presenters must please number the slides so that it is easy for us to catch. On your history pointers, you said that you had something like racial divides. My first question is that, are you still maintaining that racial divide, or now everybody is free to join pointers? And also on the issue of one-third, if the two-thirds are blacks, who is therefore the one-third? On the day-to-day cover, it says provide a comprehensive scheme. My question there is, how about the retirees? Is there a specific provision for them? Thirdly, Born Essential, I understand that you have just launched this year. What challenges have you noted so far in the Born Essential? And lastly, a question about the babies of HIV patients. Do they get the same benefits as the parents, especially concerning the ARVs? Thank you.
Honorable Mem, I think you can ask your fourth question. Are you done with the fourth? Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thanks a million. Honorable Khwari, your opportunity. Then Honorable Walter.
I'm Khanari.
Khanari, sorry.
Farrell from Northern King.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you know
him.
No,
I know him.
Oh.
Sorry,
sir.
Half a question.
Okay,
Honorable Kiria. I am Tandwe Kenge from Eastern Cape.
She's still got a problem with pronunciation of the surname. I thank you for correcting me there, Honorable Member.
We'll talk to the Minister of Higher Education. I've got only two questions. There's a slide where you are proposing the compulsory membership to widen the coverage. I would like you to, how do you probably compare or look at this in the light of the proposed national health insurance? I know it's still a proposal which is unknown, but you can, I'm sure you have applied your mind about, if you have got this, what does that mean? And also, on your other proposal, you propose that legislation should be amended to allow collective bargaining. in the health environment. Is there any legislation stopping medical aid schemes from coming together and then bargaining with the hospitals? Would that it require legislation, or is the lack of initiative from the medical aid schemes to do that? Because that will be, my understanding is that once you reach an agreement, it becomes your own arrangement, your own agreement. That's got nothing to do with government or legislation.
Thank you, Million. Honourable Waters. Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I just want to ask questions. You were placed under curatorship as a not. If you can give us some background as to what's happening about the I think the Council for Medical Schemes wants to place you under curatorship. That's correct. And if you can tell us, you know, the motivation around that and what is happening, where is that in the legal process, and how that's affected the functioning, the management of the medical scheme, as well as membership and your financial situation, all around that. And then on what basis are you objecting to the Council for Medical Schemes proposal to place you under curatorship? Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Waters. Honourable.
Thank you. I will repeat my surname, Sahalidisa. It's a double barrel. I'm very impressed for you to have even included the HIV statistic. But what I wanted to know is how do you work with the Department of Health on the HIV? Because what do you know? Sometimes the other patients are with medical scheme, with private doctors, then you find that the statistic which we normally, the department normally uses, is not really the same. And I'm happy that you say that you have been doing HCT. That's the way I understand. And, Chair, you have even said that other insurances must sort of answer what we ask, because those questions cut across. And I want to know, there is this thing of when you join the insurances, certain insurances put you on medical aid, medical examination. And if you are HIV, they don't. And I think that they don't cover you, or they don't allow you to join. And I think this is, among other things, which really puts stigma on the HIV. Because even if I am hypertensive, if I don't look after myself, I can die tomorrow. Or in diabetes, why this specific thing, which is when I'm HIV positive, I cannot be covered? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Paradisai. Honourable Grace Dube.
Chairperson, thank you. I have questions relating to chronic diseases. There was a day when I went to a doctor who asked me, because I'm chronic, if I did fill in the form that goes to the medical aid, can I get, you know, more information around that? Number two is that have you ever find yourself dealing with a doctor who's already been stripped of the role because of corruption or whatever? How do you determine who is still on the roll and not on the roll? And then about dental and optical, how many times can a person use it? And do you have specific doctors like others who deal with you? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Any other members? I've got two hands still.
Honorable Zhao, first.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to know from Bonita's and the previous, if some of the people here, the previous medical aid, at what bank did you make use of? Because the reason for my question is, at my previous job, the whole staff was part of Bonita's. And then suddenly, Bonita's moved to another bank. In rural areas, there's only standard APSA or FNB. And then it becomes a problem when the money must be in at the end of the month, and then you have to drive 300 kilometers to put the money in the bank. Because it creates most problems, because a person can get sick while he was his payment is not in and the medical did not pay. So I ask all of the medical aid, please make use of banks who is most affordable or easy to find. Thank you.
Thank you, Alwanda. Honorable Kinile.
Thank you, Chair. I am glad because my colleagues have asked some of my questions. This is my question. What happens when a person retires after he or she has been paying for many years? With Bonitas and this bond safe, and how come that money become exhausted when you pay in and out, day in and out? When you come to the pharmacist, they used to say you must pay levy or the money is exhausted. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think we will. We got one or two questions, Honourable Member. I'll limit you to two, eh? Okay. Honourable Murray.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Mine are just two questions. There's one slide. It talks about the history. We've got the last bullet saying the third-party administrator and managed care provider med scheme. I'm not sure. I would like them to just give us a sort of a structure, like we had with Discovery, to say this is the hospital, this is the administrator, this is the scheme, blah, blah, blah. Because, you know, with some structures, it might be taxing to the beneficiaries or the members, just to have an idea of exactly what is going on. And then... No questions jotted on. Yeah, maybe just in short, we saw with the Discovery, like you said, it's unfortunate that you had to present second. So I was actually very, very impressed with the programs that they put in place in terms of when they see or suspect any fraud or corruption. You know, as a bonnie tuck, what have you done? Because I think you've always been affected by the same, you know, types of, you know, fraudulent and whatever. So what tools or any programs do you have, and what have you come across, what have you done? And then issues of co-payment, I'm not sure if my colleagues have asked about that, to say, I mean, how are you dealing with that in your scheme? And then, yeah, what is your admin fee? That's where the percentage of your admin fee, because I see you've got the third party. So it will be very interesting to know who goes where, how much in terms of percentages. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Now I'll hand over to Mr. Gerard from... Do I pronounce your name correct? M-Minus. Okay.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll go through the questions one by one. The first question related to Bonitas. No, it was just to give an overview where it started all, that it started in this very parliament. It's an open scheme, and anybody that can pay the contribution can join. And after 28 years, the demographics is still two-thirds black people, and the other one third is the rest of the population. With regard to day-to-day benefits, there's a slight difference between us, and I tried to point that out, and the previous presenters, that our emphasis is on we provide those day-to-day benefits and we take a risk on them. So you may find that there's a limit on them, and then it gets exhausted at some stage. Your question on the Bond Essential, it's a very new product. It was only launched this year. It's only a hospital cover, and we're competing with insurance products out there. So our biggest single challenge are these products that one can see on TV that says, if you go in for a major event, we'll pay out 100,000 rand or whatever. So yes, there are definitely challenges for this product that I asked for. With regard to the babies of HIV patients, perhaps you would remember or recall that the previous presenter and I made a reference to that technology normally increase our cost, in the sense that people, the more advanced technology is available, the more people want. The success story about HIV is that it's the opposite. When I started in this industry in 1997, it cost us around 4,000 rand to treat an HIV patient that was on antiretrovirals. Today it cost us just below 800 rand per patient. So I agree, there should not be any longer a stigmatization to this disease. It's actually one of the cheaper chronic diseases to take care of. Mm. And the answer is yes, we do provide it to the babies as well. The real success story is that we're taking care over 10 years now of most of our patients, and they're all very productive in this economy still today. The real cost is only at the end of their lifespan, where there's admission to a hospital. But it is one of the cheaper conditions, chronic conditions today. On the question on compulsory membership versus national health insurance, it's really actually something that one would like to spend a lot more time on, but if I can maybe just point one or two things. One of the problems we have in this country is affordability, and affordability directly relates to hospital cost. We have what I would like to call in this country, the private hospitals are five-star hospitals, and they're very expensive. There's a number of overseas models where not all hospitals are equally equipped, equally level of care, and you then pay less. So I would almost like to see that we see hospitals that have different levels of service that people can have access to. That's one of the big things. Compulsory membership, it can be replaced by the National Health Insurance. There have to be more people participating in health cover. There's always, on the one hand, the right of people to health care as a basic right. And on the other hand, what is affordable for the individual. And in between that, there will always be some sort of tension level. But the gap is just too big for us at the moment. So whether national health insurance provides the primary health care for everybody, it will substitute a portion, a large portion of that compulsory membership that we foresee that all people that participate in the formal economy should belong to. On collective bargaining, and yes, we have attempted, and there's a specific ruling from the Competition Commission that schemes are not allowed to collectively bargain for hospital tariffs. As I said, my colleague that's going to present after me will touch more on the subject, but it's an unfortunate situation. Although I'm in favor of the Competition Commission's way of doing its business, there are something that healthcare may be regarded or seen as like basic food. that it should be exempted from certain things, allowing to optimize it for the members on the ground at the end of the day. With regard to the curatorship application, please forgive me if I don't go into detail. It's still sub judice. I can't discuss all the things. Yes, there's been an application that was launched on the 22nd of January by the Council for Medical Schemes after a investigation took place last year under Section 51 of the Medical Schemes Act. How did it affect the scheme? We lost about 5,000 members in that period due to bad publicity and also some other things that play a specific part. We believe that the basis of the application is not a sound one, and it does not require curatorship of such a astute, well-established financial medical scheme, that there are other ways of means and dealing with it. We try to negotiate with the Council for Medical Schemes on this basis. Unfortunately, this negotiations broke down. The scheme, as you could see, have 35% reserves, over 2 billion rand of reserves. It is financially very sound and healthy, and there are at least to my own mind, only two big ticket items that cause all of this, and they are all either fully addressed or in progress of being addressed at the moment. Then on the question of medical examination, when people are examined HIV and you have to disclose it, medical schemes are not allowed to disclose that. And we are not allowed to discriminate at any point in time. We exist to take care of sick people, so we cannot start excluding certain people on their medical examination or their status. Yes, we are very active with a VCT program over the past 18 months. We've tested around 30,000 members of our scheme already. It is in our best interest to take care of those members. As I pointed out earlier on, they are a productive portion of this society, and we need to maintain them there. There is no difference between that disease than any other chronic disease. With regard to the chronic register, the form that you were required to register with, we have, like Discovery and most schemes, we have programs where we try to manage the cost to ensure that members receive the most appropriate, affordable care at that point where they need it. So what we normally ask the patient is, when your doctor tells you today that you suffer from a chronic condition, let's say diabetes, that you have to complete a form. That form allows us to register you with the scheme, and we manage it then to see whether there are compliance from the patient side. Does the doctor take good care of the patient? Are the most appropriate care rendered to that member? So it's really, it's a communication process between us and the patient to say, talk to us so that we now know you have this condition and that we help look out for you in that instance. With regard to doctors being struck off the roll and fraudulent, yes, we have also a fraud management program. I think what haven't come up yet in the presentations is that we also belong to a collective body under BHF, which has a fraud management environment. We follow exactly the same pattern in the sense that we first identify or detect these patterns. Then we investigate them professionally with professionals. If we then come with some evidence, we normally engage the provider. And we often find that they would like to settle, which is the acknowledgement of debt. Or, depending again on clear evidence, whether it's criminal or not, we will report it to the police and we report it to the professional society as well. There are, unfortunately, a strong correlation between the provinces that really struggle economically and fraud in the healthcare industry. The Eastern Cape, KZN, and Gauteng are by far the three provinces that's the highest on the list for these kind of providers. I don't think Gauteng struggle economically. I just think there's so many providers that the frequency is very high. With regard to dental and optical network services, yes, we have signed up designated providers that provide optical care for our members over a two-year period. So over 2 years, you're entitled to go for a full service eye test, a new spectacles, whatever is required. So it's a 24-month benefit period for that benefit. And with dental, it is mostly a capture on the frequency and stuff, but all basic dental are covered under it. It's one of those services we believe is imperative for people and individuals. On the question of banks, the banks, we normally engage or entertain most of the big banks. We have Nedbank, Standard, and FNB. The challenge that we often face is that these banks are not always present, a footprint in the small rural areas, or they have agents that are very limited that act on their behalf, and they cannot conduct this business. We have made some inroads there and improved that. We've extended it now to the six big banks to hope that we can accommodate our members, but we're quite aware of that there is a problem out there. Then on what happened to retirees and when they end their membership with the medical aid on their savings account, the issue is the following. The savings account always belonged to the member. I only administer. I can compare it to VAT. VAT never belongs to me. I take it with the one hand and I give it to the receiver. The same with the savings account. I just spend it on your behalf and hand it over to the next person. So if you retire and there are monies in that savings account, it will pay out to you as a member. The only problem is the first man always in line is the tax man. He's first going to tax it and then give you your portion, but it belongs to you as a member. With regard to co-payments and these kind of things, it is, and I refer to it as one of the major challenges for us in the industry, is because it's uncertain and we don't know what the provider charges, that you will often arrive at a pharmacy and the pharmacy will say, pay an admin fee, pay a this. We're not allowed to pay an admin fee because it's not a medical expense. But the pharmacist is entitled to ask how to run his business. So there's a discrepancy between us that's taking the risk and what a provider is allowed to do. Now, I just hope we never get to the point where Zimbabwe is at the moment. I listened to a presentation, and I'm serious, on the healthcare very recently, and they had two major problems. The one is that the insurance, which is the medical aid, don't even talk to doctors, and the doctors don't talk to them. So the one charges whatever he wants, and the one pays whatever he wants, and the poor member or patient is left in the middle. The other problem that they have, and it became the acute one now, is that the value of the money declined so fast that when the doctor charged them 2,000 Zim dollars, by the time he receives it, it's not the same value anymore. So what I'm saying is, at some stage, we have to address this problem in the sense to say, doctors, yes, you can, but you have a ceiling. You cannot go beyond. Medical aid, you have a minimum that you have to pay. You cannot run away from. And we'll have some sort of parity in the system. But it is a problem. Then on the structure of MedScheme, sorry, I made the assumption that once Discovery presented that, that model would be known as a generic model. So what we are the scheme. So we are Board of Trustees, and it has one or two executives working for the scheme, which is a non-profit entity, and we contract out all the administration, the process of claims, these managed care programs and stuff to a third party, which is called MedScheme. They in turn then deal with the service providers, the doctors and the pharmacists on our behalf. But we are the registered scheme, then outsource that services to MedScheme. What is our admin fee? It's 10.1%. Most schemes' healthcare or non-healthcare expenditure is in the region of about 12-13%, which is paid to brokers, administration fee, and managed care fee. In other words, between 85% and 89% of each healthcare rand, we spend directly on purchasing health services. And then, Chairman, yes, I've already responded on the fraud to say yes, we have similar programs, and our approach is very much the same. And I can mention to you that it amounts to millions of rands every year that we recover or that we hand people over to the police.
Thank you, Mr. Eminis, for his answers and the presentation. I think we are running a little bit late now. I won't allow another round of questions. Thank you, sir. I'll call now the principal officer, Katie Calder, of Pet Health Medical Care. Well, I'm still getting ready. Members, at 12:30, you must excuse me, please. I've got another meeting. So if you're not finished by then, I'll ask one of you to chair the meeting for me. Are you ready?
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I will, being the third in line, I was aware that a lot would have been covered, so I've kept my presentation short and simple so that we can focus on the areas where your interest lies in terms of questions. Not sure why this is not waking up. I don't know if somebody's maybe switched off the Proxima. I think just as that's starting, by way of introduction, what we look at in terms of medical schemes or the medical schemes environment is really a means of financing healthcare. And it's really a type of insurance. So if you think back, I mean, if you think of what is insurance, it's pooling of risk. So everybody's contributions come in to pay for the benefit. Now, historically, sorry, let me just quickly find. I think if we look back into the 90s, if we look back in time, there was a time when medical schemes were run very much much more on insurance principles. So there was risk rating. So what that meant is, you saw in the previous presentation, there was a graph that showed that as we get older, our claims costs go up. You know, when you're in your 20s, you seldom suffer from chronic diseases. There are very few chronic diseases that cover young people. It's just your maternity cost in your 20s to 40s. But as we approach age 55 and onwards, that's when we get the onset of these lifestyle conditions. So other than HIV, which is a bit of an anomaly, most chronic conditions, the onset is around 55, and associated with that is often increased hospital costs. So in an insurance model, if you were looking at it as a profit entity, we used to risk rate. I'm an actuary, so in actuarial terms, what you used to do is charge for the risk. So you used to charge a lower contribution for a person that's low risk and a higher contribution for a person that's high risk. But if we look at society in total, it's an undesirable approach, because what we want is solidarity in terms of the pricing principle, and that says that that might be the right way to price for risk. I mean, it might cost, a sicker person might cost more, therefore you might feel justified to cost more. But society is saying, in social solidarity principles, that that's not equitable. It's not what we desire as a society. We would like to say that it's not fair that you charge a sicker person more than a healthy person. So that's the principle. And if we come back to the ANC Health Plan of 1994 and the introduction of the Medical Schemes Act of 1998, what that was a fundamental statement in saying that as a society, we do not want risk rating, we want community rating. And that's one of the fundamental principles that the new act introduced, is community rating. So as a medical scheme, you are no longer allowed to charge an older person more than a younger person. You have to charge everybody the same. The only problem with that is that a younger person might not see the value in paying the same contribution for those benefits as an older person, because they're not likely to claim. So the value to an older person who's likely to claim is obviously higher than the value to a younger person who's not likely to claim. So the younger person, as we've seen, and I will go to it again, often chooses to opt out of the system. But the system's sustainability is dependent on having everybody in the system. We can't, if we have a system that only has the older and the sicker people in it, it will cost more. It will be unaffordable for those people. We undermine the principle of what we're trying to achieve there. And so that's why we need to see the system in totality. And if we go back to the ANC Health Plan of 1994 and the Medical Schemes Act, as my colleagues previous to me have said, we've started the route of going this way, but the problem that we have is we've only introduced a piecemeal. There's some parts of the intended legislation that haven't been introduced yet, and those are the parts that we need. And if we can introduce those, we can make it more affordable for everybody. Because as we've seen, our biggest challenges in terms of healthcare is affordability and the ability to cover more people in the country. We cover too few people still. And at the moment, the legislation is stacked against us to try and bring. We're trying to do everything we can to bring more people in. So we need to relook at what is our goal. Our goal is universal coverage. We want everybody in South Africa to have affordable, quality, and accessible healthcare. That's our fundamental goal. So if we come back now to FedHealth, in the time, the other part that happened at that time is the new medical schemes that also introduced not only open enrollment, community rating, but also open enrollment, which said that you can't deny anybody access. So if you are HIV positive, I can't say to you, sorry, you're too expensive, I don't want you. I must cover you. That's my purpose. It's to cover everybody, even if they're sick. So you cannot refuse anybody. In the insurance model, in life insurance, you can say to a person that we're going to exclude you for this condition because it's not financially viable for us. But we need to look at medical very different. Life insurance, people aren't really looking to die. In short-term insurance, people don't really want their house to burn down and they don't really want to have their goods stolen from them unless it's fraud. Medical is different. It's a very different principle because it's something that you're trying to access. So if we come to governance, historically, schemes were closely associated with the administrator, and now the Medical Schemes Act has completely separated that. So the governance structure has improved significantly. So for example, I'm the principal officer of the scheme. I'm not allowed to be associated with or employed by the administrator. We're a separate entity. We are a not-for-profit entity. All medical schemes are trust funds. And we have a board, and we have some of our trustees here. We have a board of trustees, which must be at least 50% member elected. So in our case, it just happens to be 100% member elected. And FedHealth particularly prides itself on its governance and its independence, because FedHealth was born, it existed, but it the current FedHealth scheme was born out of the FedShore debacle, where the trustees stood up and said, we're not going to just go wherever you push us. We are here to represent members, and therefore we will determine our own future and who will administer us and where we sit. And as a result of that, FedHealth has a board of trustees that has a lot of expertise, and as I said, they strongly pride themselves on their governance and their independence. In addition, because of this, and because the trustees are there on behalf of the members, we have a very open-door policy for members. Obviously, there are few trustees and many members, so the majority of membership queries are handled by the administrator through our extensive call centers and through email queries. But the board members are able to escalate queries if they feel they're not being dealt with up to the level of the board or to myself. So So if we come back to a scheme, what is a scheme really? And if we look at Fed Health in the center there as really a pot of money, our main and only source of income is member contributions. So that's our source of income. But as we said, all schemes must hold at least 25% of contributions in reserve. That's our solvency margin. So because we hold those funds, we are able to get some additional income, and that's the little money tree on the bottom left-hand corner. That's investment income. And what we do is we use that to also assist members, so that money also goes into that pot. And predominantly our main ambition is to pay for healthcare expenditure. But in order to do that, as you've heard through the course of today, it's actually quite a complex environment. And so administering this complex environment and ensuring that we only pay for what we should pay for and that we manage the funds appropriately, we unfortunately do have to incur some operational costs. But by far, the largest amount of money that we spend is on healthcare expenditure. But you can see here immediately that that's the reality is the only money coming in is what you pay as a contribution as a member, and most of the money going out is to pay doctors, hospitals, nurses, pharmacies, healthcare expenditure. The problem is there's almost unlimited demand in terms of healthcare expenditure, but we definitely have limited income. And it's this balancing act of trying to balance affordability of contributions while adequately covering claims costs that leads to the disconnect you feel as a member, that you feel that, well, I've paid, and I've paid so much, therefore I should have unlimited benefits. But unfortunately, the pot of money is very definitely limited. And that's where the disconnect comes. And that's why it's so important for us to try and find the best way to manage those funds so that we truly can make people healthier. I think in terms of our different options, if we look at contributions, we've seen from the previous two presentations that there's a variety of different options. So a scheme can differentiate benefit structures. Everybody must provide what we call our prescribed minimum benefits level of cover. But we can vary our contributions. But the only way we can vary it is whether you're an adult or a child. As I said previously, you're not allowed to age rate. So everybody must pay the same contribution irrespective of age. But we are allowed to charge a lower rate for children. That's the only place where we are allowed to charge a lower rate because children really do cost a lot less. We are also allowed to differentiate our contributions based on income. And what you will find is most schemes that are looking to bring in previously uncovered lives will provide an option, a lower cost option, that has income bands. So you protect it, because lower income people actually often do also claim less. Our challenge there is that in the bracket of lower income people, if we saw anti-selection, which is the principle whereby people only will join if they need to claim, that's something that we all face, is this anti-selection, where people only join when they know they're going to get more money out than they pay in. Now, that is far, far worse if you consider an income of under 4,000 rand a month, because your income is so limited that people in that income band will even more anti-select against the scheme and only choose to join if they're sure that they're going to get out more than they pay in, because that 400 rand is it's 10% of their income. So they make that decision very carefully, and that's what makes it very challenging and very difficult to provide sustainable low-cost options to attract more people in. In addition, the problem is the requirement to cover full prescribed minimum benefits. I think if we look at the spectrum of people over income, we find that in the lower income segment, there's a need to have access for your out-of-pocket day-to-day cover. And in an affluent market, so there's a bias towards making sure you can take your child to the doctor when your child is sick. Whereas in the more affluent sector of society, there's a greater fear of ending up in a public sector hospital if you need to go to hospital. So on the one spectrum, and obviously everybody wants everything, but there's a bit of a bias between the two, where in the affluent market there's a fear, and what we need to be doing is working together in PPPs in order to build up the public sector and for us to be able to direct some of the income that we have into the public sector so that those facilities can be also used to bring in competition. I think you've seen this graph before, just for interest, to see the proportion of our expenditure, which is in terms of healthcare expenditure, So it's different for every scheme depending on your benefit design. So we spend by far the largest proportion of our funds on hospitals. That's 44%. And the next biggest category is on specialists, medical specialists, which is 18%. And a large part of that specialist bill is also what's taking place actually in hospital. It's the specialist cost in hospital. I'm going to come back to these two slides in a second. I just want to explain here in terms of how we pay for these services and how we negotiate. Now, a number of years ago, schemes used to actually, they did have collective bargaining. So schemes would sit together with each of the different provider groups and agree on the price. But unfortunately, the Competition Commission ruled that this was anti-competitive. And we believe this is a very unfortunate event because, in point of fact, it wasn't a monopoly negotiating against providers. It's actually consumers collectively bargaining with the providers. And the biggest problem we have is the uncertainty that this brings, because the way the Competition Commission has ruled, it is not possible for us as schemes to negotiate collectively, say, for example, with hospitals, whereas there are only three hospital groups in South Africa, so we actually have no choice, because of their geographical coverage, than to use all the hospital groups if we cover the whole of South Africa. So you can't actually bargain on price because you actually have to include everyone in your network if you need to cover the whole of South Africa. So we are very undermined. We do, however, because there are only three, we are able to negotiate with them in terms of certainty on price. So what we do have is we have negotiated tariffs with hospitals, so our members have absolute certainty that the hospital bill will be paid in full. The fact that we may not be able to negotiate the best price is a different issue, but at least we have 100% certainty. When we come to providers, on the other hand, that is our biggest challenge, in that there is no longer, in the old days, you will remember, there used to be a medical schemes rate, and there is now no longer a medical schemes rate. Our closest proxy is what is called NHRPR, the National Health Reference Price List. Now, that is, it's just a guideline, but what it does give us, at least, it gives schemes and providers that ability to talk a similar language, so that at least we can define our benefits in terms of something that the industry understands. And similarly, the doctors understand that there is this NHRPR, and therefore they set their rates in relation to this. The problem we have is that there's so many doctors. And with GPs, it's not really a problem. With general practitioners and most of the other healthcare professionals, other than specialists, they generally will charge out of hospital at an NHRPR rate. And so it's very easy to get parity there, because the majority, by far the largest majority of general practitioners, will charge in relation to NHRPL. However, specialists don't follow that model at all. Therefore, that is where you end up with a situation where we need to define our benefits in terms of a fixed rate, but the doctors may charge more, maybe 120% of NHRPL, maybe 300% of NHRPL. And because there's such a shortage of specialists, they are not really interested in negotiating for price. They already have more business than they need, so they do not want to discount their price. And that leaves us in a very difficult bargaining situation. And that is where we've come to the situation in terms of PMBs, of saying if you are forced to pay at any cost, we are forced to take on a check of an open-ended liability. How can we manage our funds, which we need to manage for our members, if we are forced to pay at any cost? In terms of medicines, however, we have had legislation to control the price of medicine, so we now have a single exit price. And what's quite interesting to see, if we go back to the previous graph, is that in 2003, the medicines regulations were introduced in May 2004. So I've looked at the expenditure for the whole of 2003, and you'll see that medicine was 17% of claims in 2003. Whereas with the price control on medicines in 2009 only make up 10% of total expenditure. And that's not because of a reduction in paying for medicines. We are, in fact, paying, as you've seen from the slide in Discovery, there's a constant increase in the prevalence of chronic conditions that we cover, but the price has been well contained. In terms of other areas where we've seen a tremendous increase, the one has been specialist costs. And the other one, and that is as a result of the end of the Competition Commission ruling, where we were no longer allowed to participate in collective bargaining. Another area is because of new technology. And the one example I can give you in terms of new technology is in the area of oncology. Now, here we have these new biological drugs that are extremely expensive. And you can see, I think over that period from 2003 to 2009, our oncology costs have gone up almost 300%. Now, some of these drugs are extremely expensive, and what we do as a scheme in order to manage these costs is we have funding policies. So, for example, we have a case currently with us whereby a patient is seeking treatment. They are at fourth stage of cancer, and this additional drug will cost about 400,000 rand. But from the best clinical evidence, all we can see, we see an expected increase in life expectancy of less than 3 months. Now, as a fund that's balancing the needs of all our members, can we justify spending 400,000 rand where the clinical evidence for this drug is an increase in life expectancy over the current treatment of less than 3 months? These are the decisions and the clinical expertise that happens behind the scenes in our managed care funding protocols. And it becomes extremely complex, and that's why you've been grappling today with the complexity of what we do and why it's so hard for a member to understand, but you must pay for everything. There aren't unlimited resources, and we are constantly ensuring that we balance those needs as best as possible. So in terms of price, we have the need for certainty. But as I was saying, and we said earlier, there's two sides. There's price and there's utilization. The other area we need to control is in terms of utilization. And because we sit in a fee-for-service model, that means, for example, you pay your medical scheme, but you don't pay your doctor. You don't see, members don't necessarily make that direct connection between going to the doctor and the fact that if they go too often, it will lead to more claims, which will ultimately push up their contribution rates. So we need to work together with the doctors. We need to work with the members and with the doctors. It's education about bringing all parties together. Because if we consider doctors, even in their training, they are not trained in any way to consider the impact on cost of their decisions. They don't consider cost in treating their patient. They never consider, it's a very difficult, if you consider somebody at the end of their life who's extremely sick and is likely to die in the next 6 months, how often, because they are seen, there's a sense that there's unlimited funds from a medical scheme, for people to continue, doctors to continue to put people on ventilators where perhaps they should be making a difficult decision at that point in time to say, you know what, why don't you go and be with your family and let's stop trying so hard to keep you alive at this point because you actually have no quality of life anymore. Why don't we have palliative care? But it's a very difficult discussion that people don't want to have. So quite often we keep throwing more money because it's so hard to say that actually we actually cannot cure you anymore. What we need to do is make you comfortable. What we need to do is ensure you have quality of life. We can't keep putting more and more drugs into your body to try and keep you alive when sometimes the quality of life is not there. But because it's a very difficult, but those are the real questions that schemes have to grapple with, and we don't have the ability to do that. In the public sector, those decisions get made quite often. There are no more funds. But we can't say just because we're in the private sector that we shouldn't be making those decisions, but we have no power over that. So we often end up spending money in the public sector that wouldn't happen. Unfortunately, the doctors there are forced to make those life and death decisions. In the private sector, those life and death decisions don't get taken. We just keep putting more resources. In terms of other ways in which I think my previous colleagues have talked about disease management programs that we have to try and assist patients. So, for example, particularly diabetes is a very good example where you need to keep people's blood sugar controlled because if it's not controlled, they will end up in hospital. And we have quite an extensive program there to assist members. Similarly, with HIV, we have an extensive program, and our call center agents are able to speak to members nurses, but we have an outbound call center that speaks to patients to make sure that other than their doctor, that they constantly understand exactly how important it is for them to be taking their medicine and that they do follow-up phone calls to make sure that the patients are indeed taking their antiretrovirals when they need to. But our biggest challenge in HIV is enrollment. So we are very happy with the current drive on HCT because our biggest costs come when people don't enroll in the program and they end up sick in hospital with untreated HIV, whereas they could be on antiretrovirals that would keep them healthy for longer. So our problem is because of that stigma, people don't enroll, and we really need to wipe out that stigma in this country to ensure that people do enroll, because we can keep them, as Mr. Van Emmen has said, we can keep them healthy and productive for a long period of time, as long as they just enroll in the program. I think people are always concerned about the proportion of funds that are spent on non-healthcare costs, on our operational costs. So I think if we consider what is involved in administration, so this is what we, as Fed Health, we don't do our own administration. We outsource it. But that administration company, where we are a not-for-profit entity, they obviously are a business, but they fulfill a number of very important functions for us. The one is to enroll members on the scheme, so we need to make sure that we have who we think we have, and to ensure that we receive the contributions. As per the Act, we must receive contributions within 7 days from the date that they are due. And then the business of paying claims, which is obviously quite a complex environment, particularly as you have thousands and thousands of different tariff codes for each particular procedure and each type of consultation. And I think you saw from also the discovery presentation the complexity in ensuring that there isn't any mismanagement, fraud, errors in all of that. So it's quite a complex business. Then, of course, we have our managed care protocols, which try to ensure that we get the best value for money and that we try to eradicate waste in the system. And I think there's quite an understanding in the current environment that one cannot impose rules on doctors, that we have to work with them. We then also, as a scheme, if you remember what I said at the beginning about healthcare costs go up with age, so if you just imagine that we had everybody in this room was just on our medical scheme now. If it was just us here, and this is our medical scheme, and we're going to be this group of people that cover our expenses, over time, we will become more expensive and unaffordable because we're all going to get older. Therefore, medical schemes need to constantly market themselves to bring in new young people. Otherwise, we will have an aging population, and it will be unsustainable. So we need to constantly bring in new, younger people into the system to make sure that the contribution can remain level. And then, of course, we have our overhead management cost. So just as we're getting to the end, what we said is the main points of the new legislation that were introduced were open enrollment, which means everybody must be accepted if they want to join, community rating, which means that you can't be charged more if you're older or sicker, and prescribed minimum benefits. The parts of the legislation that were not introduced was compulsory membership. So what we have is a system whereby only the people who really need the cover are joining, or as long as they're wealthy enough and they understand that. But there's very definitely a bias in the people joining schemes being the ones who need to claim more or think they may need to claim more. In addition, the same issue with the risk equalization fund. Now, because what I explained to you about age, if a scheme has a higher average age, obviously it's going to be more expensive for them to cover their contributions. Now, the whole principle of social solidarity and medical schemes was that schemes should be focusing on bringing down healthcare costs. But because there's no risk equalization fund, it would be better for me as a scheme. I could be more competitive if I could attract younger people to my scheme. So it leaves a bias in the scheme where you need to compete for your own sustainability on bringing young people in, because that will make you more competitive. And the whole principle behind the Risk Equalization Fund was to say we should level the playing field, that it doesn't matter. We want to actually encourage everyone to join the system, and then schemes can compete on efficiency of delivering healthcare rather than on efficiency and being able to attract young people into the system. So those two items will go a long way to making schemes more sustainable and more affordable, so they can be more relevant to provide cover to more people in South Africa. Income cross-subsidization I've put there in brackets because we were also looking, obviously in South Africa we are going to need some form of income cross-subsidization, and the idea had been mooted that we should have a tax expenditure subsidy, we should get rid of the tax expenditure subsidy, because at the moment we get, but let's not go there. But we do need, for us to cover more people, there has to be income cross-subsidization. There's two principles of cross-subsidization we need. The one is to subsidize the sick, and the other one is to subsidize the lower-income people. This graph you've seen before today, but what it really shows you is that graph shows you the number of beneficiaries of different age groups covered in medical schemes. So you can see in this section in the middle here, the population of South Africa doesn't look anything like this. In fact, if you look at the population of South Africa, there's a heavy bias towards youth. We have far more people under age 30 than we do have over age 30, but you can see that that's not what this graph looks like at all. So there's a definite bias there in terms of all these people not belonging to schemes. And year on year, when we look at our membership of schemes, what we see is families not covering all their children. The number of children covered in schemes is falling year on year. And that's because of affordability. So we're getting more and more anti-selection, where more and more of the healthy people leave the system, and that forces it to become more expensive. And if we look at the same graph by gender, you can see that more females in this age group choose to join. So you can see the clear anti-selection. People understand what they're paying for. They're quite astute. They only choose to belong if there's a good chance they're going to claim something. And we rely on cross-subsidization for stability. So what I would say, if there's only one legislative change that we put in place to help schemes become sustainable, it would be compulsory membership. And one would obviously need to determine a certain level of income above which one would look for compulsory membership. Because obviously it puts a price on labor if we put it too low. But certainly that would make schemes more affordable for everyone. That would enable us to bring more people into the system. The pot at the end of the rainbow that we're looking for is really accessible, quality, affordable healthcare for everybody in South Africa. And the only way that I think, other than compulsory membership, that we could achieve this would be to successfully build up the public sector so that some of the funds that we use get directed into there, and there is a way for people to access, that we build up more capability in terms of developing, in terms of this, distributing healthcare for South Africans. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the presentation, Mayor Kathy Calders. It's not always good to you members. This legislature, this compulsory membership, I do believe, whilst we are busy with the NHI this year, going here, early next year we'll be finalizing that, we must also look into that. I think this with the NHI will go hand in hand. Over to you members. I've got Honorable Kenya, Honorable Dube. Over to you.
Thank you, Sir Person. In fact, I just want to raise my concern. Maybe my colleagues are also sharing the same sentiment. The scandality of this presentation is more oral. So it's difficult to refer because mostly are pictures. So really, now you don't see where to ask because some of us are old enough, can't even memorize because the brain cells are straight now. So really, there's a problem about this presentation as you see it. I have only a few questions just because I'm concerned about Fed Health. I was once a member of Fed Health. That's where I got the questions. What happens to a member after cancelling or retiring on the issue of your investments? As you say that you have got investments, and I remember I had this Fed Health, I was paying 1.760 per month, and I never got, and then I cancelled it in 2004, and I never got anything as savings until now. Secondly, do you train your reps for as a program for capacity building? Because I think the problem is there. They come to us and tell us, and not tell us enough so that we know how the scheme goes. That is the second question. My third question, on the issue of trust funds, you say that you are dependent on trust funds. If you need any income subsidization, how do you see PPPs initiated by government? Do you have relationships with public private partnership initiation? And lastly, maybe it's a concern, I think, on the ethical codes, because the doctors and nurses are compelled by the ethical codes. it's difficult to talk about euthanasia, where you have to let the patient to die. So really, I don't know, maybe that is one of the things that makes it not easy for, as the ethical code says, that the patient talks about the preservation of life. So really, that, I think that is why it is difficult to let the patient to die. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kinea, Honorable Dube.
My question is related to the three presenters. Among them, I never had anybody who's telling us about the plowback or training of new students or capacitating people who they employ as doctors. We have students who are in universities. Do they offer bursaries? Do they recruit them and show them what they are doing so that in future either they join you or when they go to the field they know what to do? The now presenter never told us about who are they employing, because the first one is doctors and nurses. Do we have civilians that people employ in this field? And my last concern is also related to the doctor nurses from the previous presenter, the first presenter. You know, as a patient, I think this country has got a problem of nurses and doctors. But now, today, we see doctors and nurses in parliament, in this field, that they are not servicing us. Don't you think that 1 year we should start recruiting civilians in this post and leaving nurses and doctors to go to hospitals and clinics? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member.
Yes, Chairman. My question is basically legislative environment. Because everybody raised this issue of compulsory membership, risk equalization, and now you brought in the income cost subsidization. I just wanted to check whether you have applied your mind further about what will it entail if you are going to have compulsory membership. What will entail compulsory membership in terms of who must pay, how much must the person pay? What happens if a person becomes unemployed? What happens when a person has got to retire and all that? And including the issue of risk equalization fund, about what does it mean and how will it be managed? And if there's going to be additional funds, what happens? Can the money be invested to increase income? That's really what I want to.
So just ability to answer.
Thank you, Honourable.
Okay, thank you, Chair. My question was also based on that. Now that it has been asked, to add on what Honourable Grace said, it was very interesting, the social responsibility. Besides the doctors and all that, I mean, in terms of community outreach programs, do you have any? Because some of the problems you alluded is that family members take out their healthier members, you know, in terms of affording the scheme. But is there anything that the scheme itself is doing to reach out to those people to educate them more? Because now it makes sense when you say, if more people who are healthier and younger leave the scheme, it's true, you'll go bankrupt. So, yeah, if you can just allude to a few programs that you do or maybe planning to do in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Any more questions? Are we done? Okay. Over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the very relevant and good questions. To the Honourable Member over there, I think if you have savings accounts money that is still sitting at FedHealth, if you could just give me your contact details so that we can check if
if we have your money, then it should be paid back to you. We keep track of all of that, and members are always entitled, and it doesn't matter how many years have gone past. We will always pay back those monies with interest, yes. the issue that you raise of sales representatives is a crucial one, but I think simultaneously where the FISE Act, the Financial Intermediaries Advice, I can't think of the name of the act, but there's been significant work done within the FSB, FIAS, I can't think of the name of the act right now, but there's considerable work, and agents that do sell set-off must be registered both with the FSB, well, with all medical schemes, not only us, but they must be registered at the FSB and with the Council for Medical Schemes, and if somebody is not registered with both or their registration lapses, we will not pay them any commission. And we take that very seriously. And I think if one goes back in time, unfortunately a lot of poor advice was given at some stage to members. And there was a model, and it particularly I think within in terms of municipalities where people used to employ runners just to sign up as many applications as they could. And therefore, we didn't necessarily always give members the best advice, and that is something that is no longer a practice, and we do take member education very seriously. In terms of private-public partnerships and contracts with the state, we do, wherever possible, try to contract the state, but it's quite a difficult process, and the state is in some instances not quite capable of contracting with us. So, for example, in the Western Cape and in Gauteng, we have managed to secure some contracts with the state in terms of certain types of care. In terms of the Eastern Cape at the moment, the new Director General is very keen to try and create such a model, and we have engaged with him, but I think it's going to be quite a long process for us to get there, but we certainly would like to support those type of initiatives. We believe it would be of great value to be able to support initiatives in working together with the state. I think, unfortunately, the way I expressed myself, I'm really not looking for euthanasia. It's just more the principle of continuing to throw expensive resources to people who are sick when there actually isn't any hope. And quite often, if one looks at the way that drugs are priced, drugs are not always priced based on efficacy, on how well they work. Sometimes drugs are priced according to the desperation of the person in the situation. So you'll often find that very expensive drugs, the price of the drug is more in relation to how desperate is the situation of that person, say they've got multiple sclerosis or say they've got cancer, as opposed to whether the drug really works. And that's some of the challenges that we are faced with. So no, I'm not... euthanasia is another whole debate. I'm just saying that we sometimes are not ready to make that difficult decision to say, you know, actually we really can't cure you any further. You know, let's help you to feel comfortable. In terms of capacity in terms of doctors, okay. Currently, at the moment, we particularly at State Health, we do not have a program in terms of capacity, in terms of giving bursaries to doctors. We have quite limited funds, and so we're quite careful about where we spend it outside of direct medical care. However, where we do work together with, and tying up with a question that comes later on in terms of where we do employ doctors and nurses outside of their normal profession, we do have similar programs to Discovery through our outsourced managed care partner, Medscheme Health Risk Solutions. So yes, they do employ doctors and nurses within that environment in order for us to engage with the other doctors on the outside. So sometimes where possible, we will make use of, say, for example, for oncology. When we get given a treatment guideline, we don't employ those doctors. They're still doctors that work outside as oncologists, but there's the South African Oncology Society, and when we're not sure whether we should be funding something, we refer it to their professional body to say, you know, do you believe that this is an appropriate treatment protocol? And we'll use it there. But within direct employment at our managed care organization, we do employ a certain number of pharmacists, nurses, and doctors. But what we are finding at the moment is that there's a potential for us in a lot of cases where we did previously use nurses to actually use lay people with minimum qualifications. So, for example, in those chronic disease management programs where previously we used nurses to speak to the members, we're now finding that we can actually rather use a lay person to speak to the people and chat to them and just check if they, you know, how they're progressing on their treatment and are they remembering to take their drugs. So, but it is a problem that we have taken nurses and doctors out, and I think the bigger challenge we face is uncertainty in South Africa, and there is uncertainty and concern amongst healthcare professionals in terms of NHI and the fact that they are one of the most mobile professions in the world. They are societies that assist healthcare professionals to get jobs all over the world, and I think that's a real challenge we face in keeping our healthcare professionals within South Africa. The other challenge is, and I can never work out why, there's so many people who want to study medicine, and yet it's so difficult to get into any university to study medicine. So there's obviously many more people wanting to study the degree than we have capacity to train them for, and perhaps we need to look at the training capacity within our universities to be able to take on more people. In terms of the question was in terms of the impact and what impact studies have been done in terms of compulsory membership. Some of the studies have been done in terms of the impact would be on cost of employment, because for obviously what companies do at the moment is it's either going to cost the company. If it's a total cost to company type package, then it will cost the member. Or if the employer needs to subsidize the additional contribution for compulsory membership, it would cost the employer. So it would most likely have some impact on the cost of labor. But detailed studies on compulsory membership have not been done. Most of the detailed work has been done on the Risk Equalization Fund. Extensive modeling and data has been done, data provision in terms of risk equalization. That whole process has been, more focus was given initially on the risk equalization than on compulsory membership, which personally I believe it should have been the other way around. And I think we need to remember that the reason that GEMS, the scheme, the Government Employees Medical Scheme, was launched was because the government itself did not provide membership to medical schemes for all its own employees. So that was meant to be the first step in terms of compulsory membership, to ensure that government was capable of covering its own employees before it made it compulsory for the private sector. And I think we've gone a long way down that road, and therefore we've now made it possible in the government sector, and we should do the work to consider the impact in the private sector. In terms of social responsibility, as I said earlier, our funds are limited outside of direct medical expenses. However, we do spend a lot of effort in terms of member education of our own members. So not so much outside of our member pool, but we send a monthly newsletter to our members, and we try to focus as much as possible on understanding and unpacking benefit structure, because we find that is the biggest cry we get from members, is that it's too complicated and we don't understand. So what we do is each month is we try to unpack a different benefit, and we try to impress upon our members the cost of not belonging to a scheme. And I think we've done quite a bit of PR on that as well in the last year. And I think that's it from me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm not Mr. Suleiman. I think we are at the end of whatever. The honorable members have asked questions. The questions have been answered. Therefore, we need not even vote, because we are not going to take. It's just to conclude and wrap it nicely, because the man has tendency of not helping things correctly. Now, as a woman, I think you want to answer, because I still remember what. Yeah, you can do that.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted to respond to the question of Cloudback and CSI. In particular, there are a number of things that Discovery does in terms of that. We have something called a Discovery Fund, which allocates at least 10 million rands a year towards the training of specialists. And we focus particularly on specialists who practice in the rural areas and family medicine. So we're trying to address that issue in terms of the capacity in the system through that discovery fund. There are also a number of things that we do in terms of learnerships and other issues that we can handle in the company. But in terms of outreach, you also have a branch of the company called Vitality, which helps to promote health and wellness in the community. So you, for instance, you will know about the Discovery 702 Walk, you will know maybe about Discovery Schools initiatives. There are many small initiatives that we try and aim at the general community to make sure that they keep well. And I'd just like to respond also to the question on the environmental, the legislative environment. I think that's a really important issue that we should make time, perhaps, Chair, through you, to discuss further, because there are many issues that could go towards assisting compulsory membership, including reducing costs in the private sector. And there are many legislative instruments that could help us to do that. We just haven't walked down that road yet. And I think all of us would like to see more people covered with insurance. The question that you raised, Chair, sorry, on the collaboration with the Department of Health and HIV, I think is absolutely critical, particularly in terms of the statistics about which patients are treated, which patients are managed, and the uptake for VCT. And we have been working closely with SANEC and the Department of Health to help to establish a database to do that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think to Fed Health, medical scheme, the concern which was raised by Honorable Ken, to be saying that when I go back, I have to really look at the presentation is very, very critical. So that you cannot, like, understand everything when the presentation is done. That you were just giving us a roadmap. Then when we get wherever, we sit down and really peruse, because we like to know more about you. And I think with this meeting is not the only meeting which we'll be having. We are going to even have contact. I think our secretary have your contact if like we want to do follow-up questions and follow-up concern, even to invite you at our periphery, because we are here as public representatives, but the people we are representing are there. Therefore, if I want you to come to Muruli to come and explain to the health workers about Bonitas, about Fed Care, I think Fed Health, I should really be able. I so wish I was Mama King with some savings. But I will follow you up. I think with no more questions from the honorable members, I will take this opportunity to really thank the three companies to have come to us to give us the valuable information. But we are still saying that the people down there don't understand what you have just told us. Can we really go back and really sell ourselves proper so that the people must know? Because at the end of the day, we just join out of desperate to be saying that I must have. It is a must. I must have a medical aid. Then we just make somebody like myself will say, which one then? I will say Bonitas, because I have been a nurse for a long time and I have been in Bonitas. But I'm happy that at a certain stage we acknowledge that there are those little writing which you don't see, more especially after. We see them when we join, but they just vanish when you are in between. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.